Chapter 1, Introduction. In today's technology-driven world, information is cheap. The internet has changed everything for prospects. No longer do they need the big sales pitch explaining all of the features and benefits of a product. There's a website for that, and probably many of them. 98% of Americans with a total household income of over $75,000 use the internet. Of the internet users, 78% look for information online about a service or product they're thinking of buying. Prospects are savvier than ever now that they're armed with so much information on our products and services. There was a time when it was a salesperson's job to provide information, but that's simply no longer the case. A salesperson's job now entails helping prospects identify whether they're the right fit for a particular product or service. That is why I've developed a new way of looking at selling. The game has changed, and so must the rules. Salespeople have been struggling with a changing sales environment over the past 20 years. In all that time, there have been no viable alternatives to information selling. Since I began helping companies deal with their sales challenges, I have found myself constantly drawing on my experiences as an athlete to come up with solutions. As an All-American and Harvard rugby team captain, I learned to confidently navigate a field of competitors by being distinct, developing repeatable strategies, and execute a plan with commitment and passion. The comparison with sales is obvious. With the right strategy and the right attitude, victory is possible in sales and sports alike. My sales method is called game plan selling, because today's successful sales team, like the starting lineup on any championship team, needs to know the rules, develop its own unique strategy, and follow through with the plan to achieve its goals. This book will walk you through three core principles known as the Game Plan Selling DSP to help you close sales by being distinct from the competition, being systematic for every aspect of selling, and having a prospecting playbook to live by. Within each section are rules you can apply immediately to your selling career. You will learn how to separate yourself from the competition by being completely unique from others in your field. You will learn to follow a simple system to close larger sales with greater frequency in any selling situation. And finally, you will learn how to create and follow a selling plan that will allow you to achieve so much more by eliminating fear and doubt over achieving your sales and personal goals. As you begin this process to improve your sales, you will undoubtedly face moments of uncertainty and trepidation. It can be difficult to step outside of your comfort zone and learn a new and better way to sell. But if you're willing to take those first steps outside of your normal sales routine, you will discover a world of selling success that you otherwise may have never known. This is a personal journey as well as a professional one. I learned early on that success in sales is all about meeting personal goals. The more you sell, the more you can afford to have what you need and want in life. The only question is whether you have the determination to see the journey through. By simply reading this book, you've already joined an elite group of people, those who are willing to face their weaknesses, open their eyes, and explore what is possible beyond the status quo. Congratulations on taking your first step toward the excellence that accompanies game plan selling. I want you to know how happy I am that you're investing your time listening to this audiobook. I want you to succeed and experience what's out there beyond old school selling techniques. And when you do, please share your thoughts, stories, and experiences with me. Here's to successful game plan selling. Mark Wayshack. Chapter 2. How I Fell into Sales. Mark, your college fund has shrunk significantly over the past 3 months. Up until my 19th birthday, the wind had been at my back. I grew up in a small suburban community outside of Boston with a caring family. I had a lovable and devoted golden retriever that I would walk regularly at the pond behind my house. I was always a three-season athlete in high school and studied hard. When the time for college came, I was fortunate enough to earn a spot at Harvard University, where I expected sports, fun, and some studying to be my way of life. However, during the winter of my freshman year of college, I received a phone call that forever changed the course of my life. Every few months, I would receive updates about the money I had invested in the stock market. This large sum of money was supposed to pay for my college tuition over the next 3.5 years. Thanks to some explosive stock growth over the course of my childhood, a small sum of money invested by my parents had grown exponentially by the time I was ready for college. This call, however, turned my reality upside down. What was once enough money to pay for all of college was now not even enough to get me through the end of my freshman year. Like many others, I had just lost my savings to a stock market crash. This sudden need to contribute to paying for our college tuition spurred my brother and me to start a business. During our search for a business idea, we came across a company looking to sell some promotional equipment. The equipment included giant inflatable characters, hot dog stands, moon bounces, and searchlights that we could use for grand opening celebrations at retail stores. We took out a loan from a bank, bought the equipment, and instantly became young entrepreneurs. It was exciting, but we were clueless. I somehow expected business to start pouring in once we opened shop. That wasn't the case. I quickly realized that I would have to learn to sell if our business was ever going to succeed. I decided to go out to local convenience stores and meet with owners. I thought I would just sell our services to them and we'd be rich. I didn't even ask for anyone's advice on how to sell because I knew it would be easy. I'll never forget that first taste of being a salesman. I would walk into a convenience store and ask for the owner. If the owner were there, I would tell him what we could do to increase sales with our promotion. Usually, within the first 30 seconds, the owner would cut me off and tell me to leave, if he was in a good mood. After the first 3 attempts, I became discouraged. I didn't like this rejection, but I was committed, so I stuck with it. Each time, no success. With each subsequent rejection, I became more nervous and shy when approaching the owners. I'd been told to screw off by one gas station owner. Another told me he would talk to me after he finished up with a phone call. His phone call lasted for 2 hours while I waited with excitement in the parking lot. As soon as he hung up, he snuck out the back door. My favorite experience in that first week, though, was when I actually got the opportunity to give my presentation to a gas station owner. And in my fit of excitement, I suddenly couldn't remember what to say. After that first week, I had stopped in at 50 gas stations and hadn't made a single sale. It was a disaster. I wanted it to end. Finally, I went to my father, who had been a career salesman, and told him that I didn't think I was cut out for sales. "I'm just not the sales type," I said. "Well, you're going to have to learn to sell if you want to make this work," he replied. "I don't think I have the right personality for selling, though," I complained. In that conversation, I remember him saying, "Selling is a skill, not an innate talent that you either have or don't have." With that, I decided to invest a little money in some of the classic selling technique books. I suddenly became inspired by the possibilities of learning to become a great salesman. I committed to doing whatever it took to learn to sell. I read every book I could find on the subject, and I began to see that they generally told me the same 3 things. 1, persuade prospects by pitching your product with a smile and a fancy suit. 2, selling is a game of intuition, enthusiasm, and instinct. And 3, the law of attraction will bring you sales if you create a nice brochure, make some cold calls, and develop strong word of mouth. Armed with this knowledge and newfound confidence, I would bring my pitch book to whatever prospecting meetings I was lucky enough to stumble across. I would then proceed to put on the greatest dog and pony show they'd ever seen, wearing the sharpest suit I could afford with fake reading glasses to make me look more sophisticated. I would impress them with great visuals, charm them with rehearsed smiles, and close with a strong question like, "What else do you need to see right now to sign on the dotted line?" It was magical. Prospects would tell me how great a salesman I was. They would compliment me on my presentation. They would thank me for all of the incredible information. One prospect even told me that he thought I could sell ice to an Eskimo. I was so proud. But these people all had one thing in common. They didn't buy. After doing the same thing for a few years, I got very frustrated. To be clear, our business did grow during those years, thanks mostly to lucky opportunities and sheer willpower. And they were exciting years even with this frustration. Over the course of 4 years, I built a business while earning a college degree, leading the Harvard rugby team as its captain, and being honored as an All-American athlete. Then suddenly it was all over. After graduation, the excitement waned. I left with increasing pressure to sell more. I had to turn around an underperforming business, and I knew there had to be a better way to increase our sales. Why couldn't I find more prospects? What was causing some of my best prospects to suddenly disappear on me? Why were customers beating me down on price? How come prospects would tell me one thing and then go do another? By this point, I was calling the same list of 50 prospects each month. I made follow-up call after follow-up call, asking if anything had changed, and nothing ever did. Then something truly life-changing happened to me. I found a group of mentors that saw sales from a completely different perspective. These true sales experts saw everything the opposite way, and slowly selling began to make sense to me. I could see why I had the challenges I did. Here's how it began. One fateful March afternoon, I paid $10,000 on my credit card to join an intensive sales coaching program and set out to learn everything that I possibly could. Over the next few months, I became obsessed with learning every selling technique that they had to offer. After their trainings, I would go home and type up every single script, line, or concept that I could glean from their wisdom. It was all so different from what I had learned up until then. I loved it. Within 6 months, my business was in a totally different place. I'd landed some major new clients, including Subway sandwich shops and Getty Petroleum, thanks to what I had learned. After another 6 months, we received an offer to sell to a competitor of ours. After much negotiation, we took the offer, and at 23 years old, following my passion to master modern selling, I went on to become one of the youngest sales trainers in America. During that next year, I trained organizations, large and small, experimenting with my own techniques while continuing to research and interview some of the top salespeople in a wide range of industries. Now that I understood that selling wasn't about a persuasive pitch, intuition, and the law of attraction, I began to understand what the best salespeople out there were really doing. Moreover, the techniques which worked began to remind me more and more of my experiences playing competitive sports. Selling wasn't just a game, it was a very competitive one, where the top 5% of salespeople out-earned the other 95%. Over the years and throughout the process of honing my sales method, I realized I had a unique selling technique based on three core principles, or the game plan selling DSP, which helped me close sales by being distinct from the competition, being systematic for every aspect of selling, and having a prospecting playbook to live by. Chapter 3. Why read this book? The 31 Most Common Struggles in Sales. Do you or your sales team struggle with some of these issues? Can't get through to C-level people? Not reaching decision makers? Being outsold by the competition? Competing mostly on price? Sales cycles too long? Losing too many sales? Losing business to low-priced competitors? Dealing with unqualified leads? Dealing with prospects that can't afford you? Prospects that are thinking it over suddenly disappear? Wasting time on prospects that go nowhere? Getting shopped around? Inconsistent sales results? Too busy to manage your sales load? Salespeople aren't closing the business? Not prospecting enough for new opportunities? Salespeople don't have a clear sales process? Increased competition? Down economy is hurting margins? Salespeople are busy but not productive? Salespeople are professional visitors and order takers? Give prospects quotes never to hear back? Salespeople struggle to sell on value? Lack motivation within the sales team? Not many A players on the sales team? Reluctant to make new sales calls? Would be in serious trouble if lost number one client? Not sure what to say in sales meetings? Tend to speak most of the time in sales meetings? Prospecting calls simply are not working. Not getting enough referrals. If you said yes to any of these challenges, it's probably due to one or more of these three issues. Number one, prospects perceive you as like other salespeople and therefore salesy. Number two, you lack a systematic sales game plan. And number three, you don't have a clear day-to-day prospecting playbook to follow in order to be successful. The Game Plan Selling DSP is designed to help you deal with the issues above by being distinct from the competition, being systematic for every aspect of selling, and having a prospecting playbook to live by. Within this book are many ideas that you can implement immediately. I challenge you to implement as many as possible. The key to everything I present is that I give you a simple and easy to use system. You have 900 other things to worry about. How you sell should not be one of them. By using this system, you will no longer have to think about what to do next. All you have to do is follow the system. Chapter 4. Be distinct from the competition. When I first learned to sell, most sales trainers had the same advice. Persuade prospects by pitching your product with a smile and a fancy suit. You might think I'm exaggerating, but I'm not. This is what most of the sales literature out there says to do. In reality, this approach sends up red flags in the mind of the prospect. A sales style dominated by persuasion sounds like this. I'm going to throw up on you with all of my information, even though you don't know if you need, want, or have any use for what I have to say. And I'm going to do it with a slick, inauthentic style so you won't trust me. Client case study. I once worked with a high-end hotel that struggled with sales despite having an intelligent and charming sales staff. The staff had been trained by an old-school sales trainer to smile a lot, use fancy PowerPoint presentations, turn on the charm, and give rehearsed pitches based on some preliminary probing questions. The result was that they were simply not closing deals, and the deals they did close were won through very competitive pricing. When I met with the general manager of the hotel, he explained that he just didn't understand what the problem was. His salespeople would often get positive feedback from prospects about how they were treated, and everyone on his staff had the gift of gab. When I asked to see a sales pipeline of prospects they intended to close, he showed me a long document full of prospective sales. The general manager felt optimistic about them, but after some more digging, I explained to him what was really going on. By doing all of the things they were doing, giving rehearsed PowerPoint pitches based on little information, being insincerely smiley and friendly, trying to persuade prospects rather than understand them, the sales staff were acting like all the other salespeople the prospects had ever met. It's not that this stuff is inherently wrong, it's just extremely common. When they were perceived to be like every other sales team out there, that high-end hotel instantly had no more value to the prospect than a group of people begging for money. There was a time when these old-school sales techniques worked. It was about 70 years ago, which was when they were first developed. Back then, prospects were not used to the salesy approach. They had little access to information on products, and they had much more time to spare without all of the distractions in today's society. Today, prospects are fully prepared to defend themselves from the pitch. In fact, they're increasingly investing in training courses designed to help buyers extract the most value from salespeople. Prospects have limitless access to information. No longer are they dependent on salespeople to access information on products or services. And prospects are busier than ever, so they don't have the time to be interrupted for a lengthy sales pitch. The average corporate employee has well over a full week of work piled up on the desk right now. Times are different in today's market, and salespeople must adapt or die. Chapter 5: The Game of Selling. Whether or not you purposely sell with a system, prospects will always buy with a system. The system they'll use has a name: the hide, cheat, and steal system of buying. Here's how it works. The prospects will hide from salespeople they deem low value by any means necessary in order to avoid a direct confrontation. For instance, one of my clients recently told me how a prospect's assistant told him the prospect was going to be out sick for a few weeks. My client sent him a get well card right away. 2 weeks later, my client saw that same prospect at an industry meeting. My client went up to the prospect and asked how he was feeling. The prospect had no idea what my client was talking about. The reality is that many of us are probably guilty of this ourselves when we buy. So ask yourself why you do it. It's probably because you perceive the salesperson to be of little value to you and you fear he will try to use some fancy headlock closing technique to get you to buy. Imagine playing a sport against an opponent you know is cheating. But instead of doing anything about it, you simply play game after game, losing each time because the opponent cheated. It seems unimaginable, but salespeople allow it to happen all the time. Think of all the times you had a sales meeting, at the end of which you scheduled a follow-up call, only never to hear from the prospect again. Knowing what I know now, I do not understand why salespeople continue to put up with this. Prospects steal from salespeople all the time. There is information that prospects want and would readily pay for in the form of consulting. Think of Boston Consulting Group just down the street from where I live. They brought in over $3 billion last year. But we foolish salespeople give that valuable information away day after day in hopes that something will come back in return. Would you share your playbook with the other team before a big game? I doubt it. What salespeople are really doing is lowering their perceived value to the prospect by giving away all of their high-end, valuable information for free. And salespeople are willing to do it over and over again. Recently, I was talking to one of my coaching clients about a prospect of his that he had gone through an entire sales cycle with, only to lose the deal in the end because the prospect decided to do the project in-house. My client had given him valuable information and free consulting, and he'd ended up with nothing in return. Just the other day, the prospect called him up to ask for another proposal on a new project. My client was proud that, rather than jumping at the opportunity to do more free consulting, he brought the prospect through the game plan selling system and got paid up front for the proposal. Most salespeople would have jumped at the opportunity to be abused and cheated by the prospect all over again. Say this with me now out loud. No more. You are an expert. Stop letting people treat you like anything but. How it got this way. Now, before you go and start a Save the Salespeople charity to protect them from the big bad prospect, let's explore how it became like this in the first place. Imagine we took a walk into downtown Boston and asked a random sample of people to describe the average salesperson. The vast majority would describe someone who seems very sleazy, insincere, think used car salesman. That's just the way salespeople are perceived. It's not one individual's fault, but rather a collective of experiences in the life of a prospect that's only further propagated by media and popular culture. If you ask a room full of salespeople to describe what they associate with the word salesperson, 100 out of 100 groups will collectively describe the worst salespeople they've ever met. Yes, even groups of salespeople will do the same. I've asked hundreds of times with zero variance. This is what we're up against. It's nothing personal, it's just reality. The profession of selling over the last century has trained prospects to protect themselves from salespeople. From now on, when you need to buy something, pay attention to how you behave when you go into autopilot prospect mode. Chances are you'll instantly go into the high cheat and steal system of buying. For example, I recently went with a friend to help her buy a couch. When we entered the store, she was sure to walk as far away from the sales counter as possible to avoid the sales associates. Finally, when she had a question, she asked for some information from the sales associate. This salesperson was very high pressure and was doing everything he could to get her to buy the couch. After a while, he said to let him know if she wanted to get the couch. My friend politely said, "Of course." She then took some pictures of the couch with her iPhone, along with the sales tag information. We left the store and went home. When she got home, she went onto Google entered in the information from the sales tag, and bought the same exact couch from a different vendor for the same exact price. Hide, cheat, and steal. In this particular case, the sales associate was exceptionally bad. But the point is that salespeople like him continue to perpetuate the negative image of our profession, and prospects know exactly how to respond. How to protect yourself as a salesperson. Whatever the prospect expects a salesperson to do, you should do the exact opposite. Think of it in terms of sports. If an opponent expects you to throw the football, and you do, you're at a disadvantage. But if he expects you to throw and you run, then you have an advantage. The same goes for sales. Doing the unexpected will always benefit you. And in the case of sales, doing the unexpected is actually lower pressure and more authentic. We must be distinct in all selling situations. But in order to be distinct, you have to stop pitching, stop the enthusiasm, and stop persuading. Or as I call it, stop the pep. P-E-P. Here's what I mean. Stop pitching. When a salesperson begins giving any type of presentation within the first half of a sales meeting, he is pitching. Jumping right into a pitch causes three bad things to happen. One, the salesperson never takes the time to find out whether he's dealing with a prospect qualified for his services in the first place. In turn, the prospect isn't given the opportunity to reveal how and where he is hurting. As a result, the salesperson is diving into a sale without the knowledge and understanding necessary to give the prospect what he needs and therefore close the sale. Two, by giving the pitch immediately, the salesperson is giving away valuable information right away, and for free. This makes both his services and his knowledge appear lower in value. I learned this lesson the hard way when I first began speaking professionally. In the beginning, I tried to give speeches for free to practice and gain experience. What I found was that no one wanted a free speech. No school, company, or organization would even accept the offer. Once I had practiced enough and felt more confident, I approached the same kinds of groups, but this time I was charging a fee. Instantly, business began to flow. Since then, I've raised my speaking fee incrementally over time. And each time I raise my fee, I always worry that I'll lose business because of the higher price. Instead, I've experienced the opposite. I now do business with organizations that wouldn't even have considered hiring me back when I charged less. Number three, when a salesperson jumps into a pitch, it triggers the prospect's anti-buying radar. You can actually see it happen. For instance, last summer there was a church in downtown Boston looking for new members. A group of churchgoers set up shop on the corner of a busy intersection, smiling and handing out free granola bars to passersby. Since I believe you can learn a lot from your surroundings, I was fascinated to watch their strategy play out. Time after time, the same thing would happen. A member of the church would give a granola bar to a passerby, and the passerby would smile and keep on walking. As passersby began to walk away with their granola bars, the church members would try to draw them back in by diving into a pitch about their church services. Instantly, the passersby would break eye contact and quicken their pace to walk away. People want to escape the second they sense a pitch is coming. Stop the enthusiasm. Being excessively enthusiastic is disingenuous and off-putting to prospects. Imagine receiving a call from an unknown number and answering only to be immediately bombarded by a loud and incredibly enthusiastic voice on the line. Hey, how are you today? What does your gut instinct tell you to do? Hang up. It's a salesperson, and you know it before he even tells you why he's calling. You don't even know what he wants, and you're already ready to hang up the phone. It's time to start being authentic in selling situations. Aim to connect with prospects by being real. They've seen the enthusiasm act a million times. By being real and aiming to understand your prospect, you come off as distinct from the majority of salespeople out there. Think of yourself as a doctor rather than a salesperson. When you go to the doctor with a problem in your knee, the doctor doesn't just say, "Well, I have the solution for you. You are simply going to love this fantastic arthroscopic surgery that we can offer. It is so great." A good doctor asks where it hurts, what it feels like, what you've been doing that might have caused that pain in the first place. Mirror the doctor-patient dynamic in your sales life. Replace all of that enthusiasm with a genuine desire to understand where prospects hurt and determine whether you can help them. Stop persuading. It would take me all day to count the number of books written on effective persuasion in the past half century. If you go to Amazon.com and search for books about persuasion, over 5,000 titles come up. That alone should be evidence enough that this concept is overwrought and passé. It's time for salespeople to stop spending all of their energy persuading people to work with them instead of focusing on understanding prospects. Prospects know the game of persuasion inside and out. And what's more, you don't even want to persuade everyone to buy from you. You want the right people to buy from you. And you can't identify the right prospects if you're focused on persuasion. I recently went looking for condos in Boston. A friend referred me to a real estate broker, and within minutes, I knew she wasn't the right broker for me. But against my better judgment, I decided to go. I was silent for the next 3 hours. She spoke nonstop about how great the properties were for me. Not once did she ask me what I was looking for or take a step back and say, "Tell me why you want to move. What would be your ideal place?" It was the longest 3 hours of my life. By the end, I felt that I would go far out of my way to find a different broker to help me buy a place that she had showed me. It was just too much persuasion. Rather than persuade, identify where your prospect hurts and seek to determine if the hurt is serious enough to do something about. Chapter 6, The Opening Play. In this part of the book, you'll learn to craft your opening play. Just like a sports team executes a tactical play at the start of the game to set the stage for success, you will open your dialogue with prospects in a strategic way. Think of your opening play as your "what I do" statement. Some sales trainers might call this an elevator pitch, but as you might imagine, the word pitch makes me queasy. Others might refer to it as your 30-second commercial, but calling it a commercial makes you sound phony, and this is all about being genuine. To give you a better idea of what your opening play should sound like, I'll share mine. Mark Wayshack's opening play. I'm a sales strategist who works with both businesses and entrepreneurs to create a game plan for selling. My clients come to me when they're losing too many sales to low-cost competitors, they're hearing too many think-it-overs from prospects, or finally, they're just getting inconsistent results from their sales efforts. Do any of those challenges ring true to you? Now, let's break down my opening play. In the first sentence, you want to tell them exactly what you call yourself or what type of company you represent right away. And then tell them the types of clients that you work with. And finally, at the end of that sentence, very briefly explain what you do. Again, keep it very brief. So my example is, I'm a sales strategist who works with both businesses and entrepreneurs to create a game plan for selling. Then in this next section, you'll notice that I say, clients come to me when. And then we briefly list off 3 common challenges that your clients tend to face. So my sentence sounds like, my clients come to me when they're losing too many sales to low-cost competitors, they're getting too many think-it-overs from prospects, or finally, they're getting inconsistent results from their sales efforts. In the last sentence, this is a very critical sentence. We actually want to engage the prospect to say what challenge he or she is facing. The sentence sounds like this: do any of these challenges ring true to you? It's very simple. More importantly, it's different from what your prospects are used to. Now it's your turn. Imagine you're meeting with a potential prospect and he asks you to explain what you do in less than 30 seconds. What would you say? Say it out loud right now and don't move on until you do. Now that you said it out loud, did you do any of the following? Did you list all of the features your product or service has? How about enumerate all the benefits that your service offers? How about, did you describe your company using superlatives like the best, happiest, the fastest, anything like that? If you did, then you just did what every other salesperson out there is doing. And as you remember, you don't want to be perceived like all those other salespeople. So what is the exact opposite of telling people about your company products and services? Tell people about the common challenges that you solve for clients. You want to engage the prospect as quickly as possible. Note that if you're using your opening play with the CEO of a large company, it will be different than if you're telling it to a startup entrepreneur. But no matter your audience, the essence of the opening play remains the same. Now that you have a better idea of what your opening play should be, take a few minutes to write yours down now. On page 36, there is a worksheet that will help you break down line by line your opening play. I recommend that you use it in order to come up with your tight and highly effective opening play. Now you have an opening play to start a productive conversation with prospects and set you apart from your competition. Type this up and practice it. This will be your go-to statement whenever people ask you what you do. Your opening play will also be useful when we go over prospecting calls in a later section of this book. Your opening play is the first piece of your new selling system. There will be no more making stuff up when you're in a selling situation. It's all about being systematic, and the next chapter will be your guide. Chapter 7, Be Systematic. One of the most common themes in the sales community is that selling is a game of intuition, enthusiasm, and instinct. It sounds nice, like it's a profession that comes naturally and requires little effort or knowledge. This couldn't be further from the truth. Selling is not a skill you're born with or without. In fact, that's a negative misconception that undermines the real nature of the game. People are no more born with the skills to sell than they are born with the skills to play golf. Yes, some people have the qualities that predispose them to being great golfers or great salespeople, but the actual skills must be learned. Every beginning golfer must learn how to swing a club a certain way in order to hit the ball properly. Every salesperson must learn a system in order to close sales. By being systematic during the selling process, you're better able to focus on what really matters, what's going on in the mind of the prospect. After developing the skills to sell, in much the same way you learn any other skill, you will no longer be worried about what to say or do next in a selling situation. Then, if something goes wrong, you can isolate what the issue was because you do the exact same thing every time. Client case study. One of my clients, Danny, is the owner of a successful internet marketing company based in Boston. Once we began working together, he instantly loved the idea of game plan selling because he was a phenomenal rugby player and appreciated the connection between sports and sales. This guy on the field was the most vicious and ferocious person I'd ever seen. That mentality also translated off the field in the game of selling, in terms of his willingness to do whatever it took to achieve his sales goals. However, Danny, like many others who sell high-end consulting services, had this problem. He would give his prospects an informative presentation only to lose the sale when they ran off to do the work in-house or just with a cheaper vendor. During our initial meeting, he gave me an example that resonated with the challenges faced by most salespeople. A large company had approached him to do a major internet marketing campaign. Since it was a huge opportunity, Danny spent days honing his pitch and even hired a designer to create preliminary artwork for the project. Immediately after the presentation, the prospect told him the presentation was to die for. They told him how great he was, how incredible the artwork, how impressed they were with his company. They told him that they had to think about it and weigh their options, but they would schedule a follow-up call over the next week or so. Danny was psyched about how the meeting went. For 3 days, he walked around on air thinking of everything he was going to do once he made that sale. He would have to hire some new staff. He might buy that car that he wanted, and everyone in the company would get a nice year-end bonus. It was an exciting time. A week later, Danny sent an email to the prospect to set up the follow-up meeting that they'd agreed upon. A day went by with no response. 2 days, No response. Finally, on the third day, he called the prospect straight to voicemail. He left a message. No call back. The prospect had disappeared. Danny was frustrated and angry. He regularly tried to get through to the prospect by phone or email over the next few months, but he never got any response. Then about 6 months later, he saw that they had gone forward with his campaign, only it was without him. They had taken all of the ideas from his presentation and used them. He was livid. He even considered suing them for stealing his ideas. But in the end, he knew it was his own fault. Danny had no system for selling, so he deferred to the prospect's system of buying: hide, cheat, and steal. Thanks to experiences like this, Danny quickly implemented the game plan selling system so that he could forever avoid being taken advantage of by his prospects. There is no room in sales for improvisation. Everything must be part of your game plan in selling. This next section of the audiobook is about creating that end-to-end game plan, from the first conversation to face-to-face sales meetings to prospecting calls. The game plan: connect, disqualify, case study. This three-step selling system lays out exactly what you must do throughout every phase of a sale, so that way you will never have to improvise again. One central tenet of game plan selling is that you must have a script for every aspect of selling. You want to know your lines so that way you don't have to think about it when you're actually in the selling situation. The three parts of the game plan are connect, disqualify, case study presentation. Connect. Sales trainers always talk about establishing rapport with prospects. That's all well and good, but a deeper connection with prospects is needed to ultimately close sales. Disqualify. If a prospect doesn't hurt in his current or future situation, then he is not qualified for your services. Your goal is to disqualify the prospect. Every prospect expects to be qualified. No prospect wants to be disqualified. Case study presentation. Most salespeople start with a presentation. In game plan selling, the presentation comes last. Furthermore, all presentations are kept to a minimum, consisting of examples and case studies rather than the features and benefits of your services. Chapter 8. Connect. As I mentioned earlier, most sales literature recommends establishing rapport with prospects. Rapport is defined in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary as relation marked by affinity. This is a positive thing. You want the prospect to have a good feeling about you, but it's also incomplete. I've had clients pay me large sums of money even though we have nothing in common personally. They just believed that I understood their challenges and knew that I could solve them. To be clear, I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't talk about the Red Sox if you and your prospect are both big Red Sox fans. I'm merely suggesting that rapport alone isn't substantial enough to build a successful sales relationship. Let me give you an example. I'm a big fan of the New England Patriots. Probably not surprising since I'm from Boston. A few years ago, I had to get health insurance through a provider since I was self-employed. An agent came over to my place and we sat down. He saw the New England Patriots plaque that I had up on my wall, and for the next 2 minutes, we bonded over our mutual love for the Pats. After that, I had a good feeling about him, but that's all it was. Then, for the next 20 minutes, he enthusiastically told me everything he believed I needed to know about insurance, never once asking me what my priorities were. In the end, I said I'd think about it. Later that day, I decided to go with a different agent. He just didn't take the time to understand my situation, so I felt no connection to him despite our common interests. Establishing a connection. The two components to establishing a connection are: 1, be perceived as similar to the prospect. 2, be authentic by seeking to understand. Now let's explore each. Number 1, be perceived as similar to the prospect. You want prospects to feel you're similar to them, not necessarily in terms of having things in common, but in terms of how you relate to their situation. This can be achieved by matching and mirroring prospects during phone and in-person meetings. Number 2, Be authentic by seeking to understand. If the prospect perceives you as salesy, then he will shut down and no connection will be established. People only open up to those that understand them. A connection with a prospect is ultimately created when he senses that you're seeking to understand his situation. Note that you really need to have both components in alignment in order to establish a true connection with a prospect. One of the two is nice, but it's not a connection. Be perceived as similar. Let me ask you a question. Who is your favorite person in the world? If you're going through a list of people you know, just stop right there because you're already off track. Your favorite person is you. Your prospect's favorite person is him or herself. It's just the way people are wired. That's how we've survived for the millions of years that we've existed as a species. At the end of the day, we must like ourselves more than anyone else in order to survive the evolutionary process. Therefore, if the prospect believes that you're similar to him, he will begin to feel connected to you. In order to be perceived as similar to your prospect, you must match and mirror him. Matching and mirroring is all about thinking of yourself as a chameleon. While you don't want to seem fake, you do want to adapt to your surroundings. There are three key aspects of your prospect that you want to mirror, called the three V's: visual, voice, and vibe. Visual, how he looks, moves, and carries himself. Voice, the tone and pace of his voice. Vibe, his mood and presence. It's your job to be perceived as similar to your prospect on all three of these fronts. Visual. One of the most important things to remember is this: dress like your prospects. Most old school sales trainers will tell you to dress to impress. Dressing to impress may actually hurt your chances of closing a sale. Imagine we filled a room with Silicon Valley startup entrepreneurs, mostly in their mid to late 20s. They're wearing t-shirts, jeans, and sandals, and it's your job to get them to buy your product or service. Would wearing a three-piece Armani suit with pointy-toed shoes and a flashy ring endear you to that group of prospects? Heck no. They will instantly shut down when they see you. Even before they hear all the great things you have to offer them, it's over before it even begins. On the other hand, if I told you to sell your product or service to a room full of New Jersey nightclub owners, that fancy outfit might be the perfect match. Dress like your prospects. I see young salespeople dressing in high-end fashionable clothes all the time, even though they sell to predominantly middle-aged men. That mismatch is costing them major sales. Voice. In terms of matching the tone and pace of a prospect's voice, it's important to listen carefully to how he sounds. If your prospect is quiet and slow-paced, change your voice to sound similar. If the prospect, on the other hand, is loud and booming with a fast pace, then match your voice accordingly. Vibe. Likewise, mirror your prospect's mood and presence by paying attention to body language. If your prospect appears shy and slow-moving, ease up on the eye contact and slow down your movements. This component of matching and mirroring also covers the handshake. Many sales trainers teach their clients to always have a strong handshake. This is a mistake. If your prospect's grip is on the weaker side, loosen yours. On the other hand, if your prospect has a strong grip, then have at it and show off that strong grip. It's all about matching and mirroring the three V's: visual, vocal, and vibe. Be authentic by seeking to understand. I know that some people reading this are thinking to themselves, he just told me to be a chameleon, and now he wants me to be authentic. That's exactly right. These two concepts are not at odds with one another, although it may seem that way at first. Stop thinking of yourself as a static personality. Humans have dynamic personalities, meaning that you don't have just one personality. You have many personalities, depending upon your mood, the environment, and necessity. The key to establishing a connection with a prospect is to match the right you to the prospect on a visual, vocal, and vibe level. In short, don't go into enthusiastic and persuasive salesperson mode. I have never experienced it before, But I could imagine that if I were to sell, for example, extreme sports travel tours, where you travel around the world with a group of like-minded, thrill-seeking people and experience extreme sport after extreme sport, then yes, I might get very enthusiastic during the selling situation. Aside from rare situations like that, the excessive enthusiasm should be left at the door. In almost every case, being enthusiastic will be perceived as being salesy, and the prospect will shut down. Just be real and aim to understand his situation. Make the purpose of every interaction with prospects about them and their specific needs. Ask questions that explore where the prospect hurts. There will be much more on specifics on how to do this as we continue going through the game plan selling system. Right now, the key is to change your mindset. Chapter 9, Disqualify. There is a wide range of reasons why a prospect isn't a fit for you. Whatever the reason, it's your job to discover if a prospect isn't a fit as quickly as possible. You're no longer in the business of convincing people to buy your stuff. You're in the business of identifying who does and does not need your stuff. As I've said before, when I first began selling, I was taught that I should give the most persuasive presentation that I possibly could. After about a year of using this old school technique, I began bringing the same PowerPoint presentation with me to each meeting. It was really nice. I learned how to make fancy graphics with moving objects on the screen, and I would list off all the benefits that the prospect would enjoy by working with me. I had my presentation down to a science. I had practiced it hundreds of times in front of a mirror and in front of my family, who, by the way, was very impressed by it. This thing was tight. Yet, when I'd go out to meet with prospects to show them all of the incredible benefits that I had to offer them, they would inevitably say something like, "This is really impressive. Let me think it over and we can go from there." Proud of myself for giving a flawless presentation, I would go buy myself a big steak dinner to celebrate the impending sale. In almost every case, though, the sale never happened. There were a few that closed, but most of the time I got lost in this follow-up phase. Looking back, I don't know how I was able to lie to myself so effectively about being a great salesman. I now know that great salespeople do not get compliments from prospects. They get orders. But back then, I just didn't know. Always stuck in the follow-up phase, I had a constant list of about 50 prospects that I would call a few times per month. Each time, nothing had changed. My biggest fear was that they would say that they decided not to work with me. I was trying to avoid no. In 2008, the New England Patriots went into the Super Bowl with a perfect record. Many critics and fans agreed that this was likely the greatest football team ever. Yet on February 3rd, 2008, the New England Patriots lost in a close game to the New York Giants. All of that praise was meaningless in the end because the Patriots simply didn't finish the job. Salespeople tell me all the time about how close they are to closing a deal or what a great job they've done in a sales meeting. It's all wasted breath. What matters is whether the prospect gives you a check that doesn't bounce. Old school selling prescribes doing everything in one's power to avoid the dreaded no. So what happens is that salespeople spend half of their time just following up on prospects stuck in their pipelines. Think about your current pipeline of prospects right now. Let's pretend you hired me to call those prospects and say the following. "Hi, George. My name is Mark Wayshek, and I'm looking for feedback on your connection with your name. Please be brutally honest. Do you have any intention of working with your name?" My guess is that most of the prospects in your current pipeline would tell me that they have no intention of working with you. But people hate confrontation, so they lead us on. And it's a terrible waste of everyone's time, but it's not the prospect's fault. Salespeople, by trying to get prospects to tell them yes, set themselves up to waste time with prospects who never intend to work with them in the first place. But we're too nice to just say no. There is an old truism in sales that goes like this. People hate a sales pitch, but they love buying stuff. We all love to buy. I could spend hours in stores like Best Buy, Home Depot, or Target. I love buying all sorts of things, but the second that I believe I'm being sold, I don't enjoy it anymore. By making it a goal to disqualify prospects, suddenly your pipeline consists of only viable potential clients, and it shrinks dramatically. This gives you much more time to focus on finding new prospects, whether it's by finishing that marketing campaign you've been putting off, making more prospecting calls, or asking current clients for introductions. What was most liberating to me when I finally adopted game plan selling into my professional life was that I suddenly had more time to get productive things done. Now that I wasn't spending half my time following up, I could focus on what really mattered: finding good prospects, closing deals, and then actually enjoying a social life. That's why you must change your goals when it comes to prospects. Your goal from now on is to disqualify prospects. This works on the concept of reverse psychology. Prospects expect you to qualify them, and they don't want you to disqualify them. It goes back to that doctor's mindset. A good doctor will thoroughly examine a patient before telling the patient if there is a solution to the problem. Only a quack would offer the solution without identifying and exploring the real problem first. We must have this same mindset with our prospects. That means that after you've connected with a prospect, it's time to disqualify. To help you do this successfully, let's first outline the differences between an unqualified prospect and a qualified prospect. An unqualified prospect has interest. A qualified prospect is hurting. The goal of game plan selling is to disqualify all prospects who aren't hurting about their current or likely future situation. I recently worked with a large mortgage company in the western part of the U.S., and they were really hurting very badly over their current situation. The salespeople simply weren't prospecting efficiently, so they weren't hitting their sales numbers. They were losing talent left and right to a tough job market, and the CEO was worried he might lose his job over the lack of performance. He still had two kids in college and needed to save his job to pay the bills. When we met, I was able to identify a lot of hurt right away. I also recently worked with a small tech startup with a three-person sales team. The salespeople were all in their 20s and had no process for selling. They were going around giving presentations to prospects, but they weren't closing any sales. What was interesting about this company was that it was very well funded by venture capitalists, and they already had one very large client. So the company actually did not have a lot of hurt over their current financial situation. Nevertheless, the CEO was very worried about the future. In a newly developing market, there was a battle raging between three companies to become the standard. Once a standard is established, the other two competitors will become second and third choices for prospects. This means the company was in a fight for its life. So an ineffective sales team didn't cause them financial hurt at the moment, but future hurt would be massive unless they developed their salespeople into top performers. The CEO had made this company his life's passion. If he failed, he explained to me, he would be devastated. Hurt over a current situation or a possible future situation makes for a qualified prospect, as long as they also have the money to pay you. Anything less means that you are dealing with an unqualified prospect that you need to disqualify. For some strange reason, the quest to find a prospect's hurt is controversial. Many sales trainers argue that you don't need to find the hurt, but rather just help the prospect see how much he will gain by working with you. That's simply faux science, and I can prove it with a simple experiment. Note, do not try this at home. Imagine that you're holding both hands out in front of you with your palms facing down. Underneath one hand, there's a stack of $10,000 in cash. Underneath the other hand, there's a very hot flame. Think of a blowtorch. You can only move one hand. Which do you move? The reality is that any sane person will move away from the hot flame rather than grab the $10,000. Human beings will go much further to avoid being hurt than to gain pleasure. Use this human instinct to your advantage. Chapter 10, Disqualification Checklist. Your primary goal in selling from this day forth should be to disqualify those prospects who aren't hurting from a problem you can solve. You do this by asking a targeted series of questions. Prospects must be able to answer your questions such that they prove themselves to be qualified. Thus, after you've connected with a prospect, begin the conversation by taking the prospect through the disqualification checklist. Here are the 6 questions of the disqualification checklist. 1. Does the prospect have challenges you solve? 2. Has the prospect fixed the problems yet? 3. Do the problems cost a significant amount? 4. Is the prospect personally affected? 5. Is he willing to invest enough money in a solution? 6. Can he make the decision? From now on, whenever you're in a selling situation, you want to identify these 6 points. To be clear, these aren't the actual questions you would ask the prospect, as they're all closed-ended questions and will not lead to discussion. Your goal is to have the prospect paint you a picture of these 6 points by asking him open-ended questions, which I'll share with you shortly. This checklist is simply for your purposes to identify whether the prospect is qualified. If you don't get the right answer to any of these questions, then your prospect is not currently qualified and you want to move on as quickly as possible to focus on prospects who are qualified. The checklist point by point. Number 1. Does the prospect have challenges you can solve? In my world, the kind of hurt that I can solve revolves around the ability to bring in top-line revenue. I help salespeople, companies, and entrepreneurs increase their sales. I don't help companies improve their operations. If the prospects are hurting badly over assembly line issues, I'm not their guy. If a prospect is not hurting over something I can fix, then that person is not qualified to work with me, period. And the same goes for you. Know what challenges you solve and only help people with those particular challenges. Here are some conversation starters that will help you identify whether the prospect is qualified for your help. Number 1, tell me about your challenges with regards to, and then your industry category that you'd fill in the rest of the blank. Number 2, give me an example of that challenge. Number 3, tell me a little bit more about the biggest challenges you face. Next point in the checklist, number 2, has the prospect already fixed his problems? This may sound like an obvious point, but I've had prospects tell me all about their challenges and completely forget to tell me that they actually have a plan in place working to solve these problems. If a prospect is in the middle of implementing a seemingly effective program that will solve his problem, then he is likely not a fit right now. On the other hand, if he hasn't tried to fix his problems, it's a good indicator that he actually may not be hurting much. For example, the computer that I'm using to write this book is 2 years old and making funny noises. I have software that backs up my entire hard drive in the event that the computer dies. Nonetheless, one of my challenges is that this computer is making funny noise and distracting me. Have I done anything to fix the problem? No. Am I hurting enough to motivate me to buy a new computer? No. I have a challenge, but the hurt isn't deep enough to motivate me to action. I haven't done anything to try to fix it because I simply don't care enough. Here are some questions you can ask to help you identify whether the prospect qualifies for your help. Number 1, what have you done to fix your problem? Number 2, how's that working? Number 3, why haven't you done anything to fix your problem? Checklist point number 3, do the problems cost him a significant amount of money? If a challenge is costing a major pharmaceutical firm only $1 million in sales, it probably isn't worth doing anything about. However, if a challenge is costing a small landscape company $1 million, that's probably a pivotal amount of money being left on the table or lost. The goal here is to identify what the challenges are costing a prospect or company in actual dollars. Exception: there are some people reading this book who sell products or services to which dollars lost may not be relevant. That's okay. I had a coaching client who sold high-end cabinets to homeowners. I never realized how much people actually spent on cabinets until I met this client. His average sale was easily $50,000. When he would take people through the game plan selling system, he would tailor his questions to find out what clients felt they were losing out on by having outdated or unappealing cabinetry. Some would say it was hurting the value of their home and give a dollar amount. Others would tell him they lacked enough storage space in the kitchen, or they were just unhappy with the appearance of their home. Either way, my client was able to pinpoint exactly what the problem of unsatisfactory cabinetry was costing his prospects. If, like many salespeople, you sell your products or services to businesses, then accept nothing short of a dollar estimate of what the problem costs the prospect. Here are some questions you can ask to identify whether the prospect qualifies for your help. 1. What does this problem cost you? 2. How much would you estimate that this problem costs you? 3. Can you ballpark what this costs you? Checklist point number 4. Is he personally affected by the problems? Salespeople love to assume that just because someone has a professional challenge, a prospect wants to spend the time and money to fix it. This couldn't be further from the truth. When push comes to shove, people won't do anything to change a challenge unless it affects them personally. If a prospect isn't hurting personally due to a problem, he won't put in the effort to resolve it. If a prospect needs to solve his sales challenges in order to pay for his daughter's college tuition, he's personally affected by the company's challenges. He's hurting if he's spending 90 hours a week chasing leads. Here are some questions you can ask to help identify whether the prospect qualifies for your help. Number 1, how does this problem affect you personally? Number 2, why is solving this problem important to you? Number 3, why are you committed to finding a solution? Checklist point number 5. Is he willing to invest enough money in a solution? You know who needs your product or service more than anybody? The person who can't afford it. Broke people are hurting more than anyone out there, but they simply don't have the money to do anything about it. I once had a prospect who owned a company in the payphone business. Crying in front of me because she needed my help so badly, she was willing to do whatever it took to solve her challenges. The only problem was that she had no money. She was flat broke. I felt awful, but there was really nothing I could do. I gave her my book as a gift and wished her the best of luck. She ultimately closed shop and found a different job. I have a right to be paid for my services, and so do you. Prospects will ultimately resent you for giving them your stuff for free. Don't do it. Rather, spend your time finding prospects with both enough hurt and enough money to be able to invest in your product or service. There is tremendous value in what you sell. You must be paid accordingly for it. The prospect doesn't have the right to demand that you tell him what your product or service costs. You have the right to know what the prospect's budget is first. If you walked away from this book taking only one piece of advice, I would want it to be that you start asking for a budget. I have a client who sells high-end landscape construction services. When I first started working with this company, the landscape architects were simply giving a quote for what their work would cost. This is ludicrous. How can you give a quote on something that can range so greatly in cost? When I asked, he told me that the typical project could range anywhere from $20,000 to $500,000. Immediately, we changed their selling process to ask prospects for their budgets. Here are some questions you can ask to help identify whether the prospect qualifies for your help. Number 1, do you have a budget to solve your issues? Number 2, what's your budget? Number 3, how much could you imagine investing to fix your problems? Note, don't assume that the first number a prospect tells you is his or her maximum budget. Simply take it as an indicator of what a prospect is willing to invest. Once you have that initial number, you can start to test that limit. Checklist point number 6. Is he ready to make a decision? Have you ever done a great job with a prospect who was hurting, really wanted your services, had the money, but turned out not to be the decision maker? If you've been in sales for any length of time, then you've had this frustrating experience. One of my clients who sells real estate would always tell me about the husband and wife dynamic in his world. He told me that for his entire career selling real estate, until he adopted the game plan selling system, he lost sales because he wasn't dealing with the real decision maker. He said that the most common scenario would be that a husband was acting like he called all the shots, when in reality, the wife had the final word. The key is to avoid giving presentations to non-decision makers unless absolutely necessary. Most often, these people only have the power to say no. They don't have the power to say yes. Always press to have all key decision makers present before you present any type of solution. Here are some questions you can ask to help you identify whether the prospect qualifies for your help. Number one, who else is involved in making this decision? Number two, is there anyone else that we need to include in this conversation before we move forward? Number three, what is your decision-making process for this project? The goal in the disqualification phase of game plan selling is to ensure that you are dealing with a fully qualified prospect. Be sure to ask questions that confirm each component of the disqualification checklist. Now it's time to learn one of the most powerful tools in the disqualify phase, the swim move. Chapter 11, the swim move. Use prospects' own force, their questions and statements, to learn more about them and keep control of the sale. When I played football, I was a linebacker on defense. My favorite play was blitzing the quarterback in an attempt to sack or tackle him. It was exhilarating because I had to break through the offensive line in order to actually make the play. There are two ways to break through the line. The first way is to go head-to-head with a lineman and overpower him to break through. This is extremely difficult, especially because most linemen are much bigger than I ever was. The second way, which became my go-to move, is to break through the line using what's called the swim move. In a well-performed swim move, I would use the offensive lineman's own force against him. Let me explain. The lineman's goal is to keep me away from the quarterback. My goal is to get past the lineman, whose strategy is most likely going to involve pushing me back. His strength is his ability to push forward, but that's also his weakness. Since I know the lineman is going to try to push me back, I let him do so. But I also move to the side, and as long as I've moved out of the way, he'll push through at nothing. I've just used his own force and energy against him. The swim move, when done effectively, is incredibly powerful. Now, how does it apply to sales? Prospects have been conditioned by both experience and society to assume the worst in salespeople. As part of their defense mechanism against the typical salesman, prospects will ask leading questions and make certain statements aimed at disqualifying salespeople. But game plan selling is all about turning the old school prospect salesperson dynamic on its head. So instead of letting prospects use the power of their questions and statements to disqualify you, you're going to learn how to leverage what they say to either close the sale or make a disqualification of your own. When it comes to the disqualify phase of game plan selling, your ultimate goal is to dig as deeply as possible in your quest to understand where and how badly the prospect hurts. Throughout this process, prospects will make statements or ask questions. These aren't just conversation pieces. They're clues that need to be uncovered in order to be useful to you. A prospect says and does everything for a reason, and you can never assume that you know what that reason is. That's why it's important to never assume you know how to respond to something a prospect does or says. Instead, before answering, you have to do some research by way of some questions and statements of your own. Imagine, for example, that a prospect asks you, "Do you work with any other clients in my industry?" Your instinct may tell you to answer immediately and probably in the affirmative to show the prospect that you have relevant experience and knowledge. However, there might be more to this question than you think. He might, as you suspect, want to do business with a company that knows his industry. But on the other hand, he might want to do business with someone who has no other clients in his industry to avoid a conflict of interest. Or if you work with his number one competitor, he might not want to work with you. Game over. The salesperson who immediately answers that question in the affirmative ends his chance of doing business with the client. Instead, imagine if the prospect asks, "Do you work with any other clients in my industry?" And the salesperson responds with a non-committal, "Great question. Why do you ask?" A possible response is, "Well, I don't want to work with anyone who already knows and works with our competitors." If the salesperson doesn't work with the prospect's competitors, then he can say so. If, however, he does work with the prospect's competitors, he can respond with a question such as, "Well, is that a deal breaker?" If the prospect says yes, then the salesperson has at least saved himself time and effort. He knows right away the prospect isn't a fit. No matter the prospect's answer, the salesperson is automatically armed with more information than he or she had before. While continuing the quest for more knowledge about a prospect, a salesperson often hears a statement like, "I worked with your competitor and it was a disaster." Most salespeople would simply agree, saying, "Yeah, we've heard bad things." But if you're in the habit of knocking your competition, which many salespeople are, you're hurting your credibility and failing to leverage the prospect's statement for your advantage. In the view of game plan selling, a prospect's negative remark about the salesperson's competitor is a golden opportunity to discover more about the prospect's hurt. All the salesperson has to say is, "What do you mean by that? Tell me what happened." Follow this throughout the sales process. Always answer a question with a question. By using your swim move, you use the prospect's own words to create an opportunity. Here are some examples of what an effective swim move might sound like. "Why do you ask?" "Interesting. What do you mean by that?" "Help me understand that." Or lastly, "Great question. You must be asking for a reason." All four of those swim moves are inviting the prospect to clarify why he said or asked something. This allows the prospect to do all of the heavy lifting for you. Now, this technique is hard to use at first for one simple reason. We have been trained our entire lives to answer questions we're asked. Literally, since preschool, you've received accolades for answering a question correctly. The only problem is that when we jump to answer questions right away, we miss huge opportunities to gain valuable information from the prospect. Plus, if our only job as salespeople was to answer questions, then we'd be obsolete. Who would need a salesperson in the days of Google? It's time to undo that learning and practice your swim move with friends and family. Just don't tell them you're doing it. They won't even notice. And if you've ever been to a psychologist, then you've seen this technique in action. Ask a psychologist like, "Do you think that I should quit my job?" The psychologist will respond with, "Well, why do you ask? Do you think you should quit your job?" They've been trained to do this in order to understand the deeper meaning behind the patient's statements or questions. Begin by practicing this in a low-risk situation like at home or at dinner with friends, and then work your way up to selling situations. Now that you're disqualifying, you can relax during a sale. It's not an arm wrestling match of wills. It's a dialogue led by you through questioning. And through the flow of conversation, the qualified prospect uncovers that he needs what you have. By the end of a proper disqualification conversation, a prospect will be eager to see how you can help him. Chapter 12, Case Study Presentation. Old school sales trainers all teach a variation of feature and benefit selling. They'll tell you to describe your product or service as a series of features that will provide benefits to prospects. Walking into a prospect's office and listing off the benefits of your services is like saying, "I'm just like every other salesperson out there." I personally used to be the king of feature and benefit selling. A sales trainer once taught me to draw a line down the middle of a sheet of paper, writing all of the features of my services on the left hand and all of the benefits on the right. That piece of paper was my entire focus during the sales call. I thought I was cutting edge, but I soon realized that everyone else was doing the same exact thing. This is the problem with sales techniques in general. A new technique comes along and it works pretty well. As a result, sales trainers start teaching that technique to all of their clients. Suddenly, everyone's using the same technique. Prospects start to see a pattern, and eventually the technique stops working. The good news is that it takes many decades for a sales technique to become commonplace. The first core principle of game plan selling is to be distinct from your competitors. The way to do that in a presentation is twofold. First, make your presentation the last part of your sales meeting. By having a meaningful 30 to 60 minute conversation about the prospect's business or situation before giving your presentation will automatically set yourself apart from all of the other salespeople. Prospects expect you to rush through a few probing questions and then get right to your pitch. You and your services will immediately seem higher value to the prospect when you take the time to ask good, meaningful questions. Second, give as short a presentation as possible. That presentation should be based predominantly on case studies, real-life examples of comparable sales situations and their outcomes. Examples are infinitely more powerful than lists of features and benefits of your product or service. Not only do case studies make it easier for prospects to grasp what you can do to help them, but they also make your presentation much more interesting. Just think back to your high school history class. Did you ever learn about the 13th century English king Edward I and how he treated the Scottish people? Even if you did, you'd probably forget by now. But if you've ever seen the movie Braveheart, there's no doubt that you remember what the British did to the Scottish in the 13th century. How to use case study presentation. It's your job to be ready to present a case study or two based on the type of hurt your prospect has. I will share two case studies that I regularly use. One type of client I deal with quite regularly is a mid-size $3 to $50 million company with sales teams ranging from 5 to 50 salespeople. The most common types of hurt these clients suffer from are the following. Prospecting techniques that once worked are no longer working. The sales team has a decent pipeline but isn't closing a lot of the deals. And there aren't a lot of A players on the sales team. In other words, the top 20% of salespeople outsell the other 80%. I'm always prepared with case studies exemplifying each of these three types of hurt. After I've connected and decided not to disqualify the prospect, I'll give the prospect a brief presentation of case studies based on the type of hurt exhibited. One case study that I would use. One client that had these issues mentioned was a bank that I had worked with. The bank had 25 salespeople with a range of titles, from vice president to customer service representative. Money was getting tight. Any prospecting techniques that had worked during the years of high liquidity no longer worked. The salespeople were stuck chasing the same fruitless leads that they had in the past. There were three star salespeople on the team. The rest were B and C players. This client of mine needed to appeal to more upmarket companies in order to lend capital and avoid bankruptcy. When I began working with the bank, the first thing I did was assess its existing sales team. I looked for its strengths and its weaknesses. After discerning what needed to be improved upon, I worked with the entire sales team in 3-hour segments every 2 weeks. I taught everyone a uniform selling system so they could all speak the same language and identify where and when problems were taking place. This was the start of a total sales culture transformation. The salespeople began to monitor their daily prospecting activities. After 2 weeks of compiling that data, I brought them together to pool their information. Based on what we had discovered about their prospecting habits, we worked together to create a sale-generating plan for daily prospecting, the prospecting playbook. Next on the agenda was a new hiring process. The bank needed more A players, and I suspected that their existing hiring process was a roadblock. The management had a very informal hiring process based on the feeling they got about job candidates. Together, we revamped the system. The new hiring process consisted of a scripted phone interview followed by a rigorous online assessment to determine candidates' sales qualifications and relevant knowledge. If candidates did well enough, then they entered into a series of interviews designed to simulate selling situations common to the banking industry. Within 3 months of instituting its personalized game plan selling system, my client had hired 5 strong salespeople. The existing sales team was spending its time on prospecting activities that actually led to sales. Morale was higher than it had ever been in years because the team had a clear plan for success. And most importantly, commercial sales with a mix of lending and services had increased across the board. Another case study that I would use. Another type of client that I commonly work with in my Platinum coaching program is an entrepreneur with revenues of between $250,000 to about $5 million per year. This person is often the key salesperson along with many other responsibilities. An entrepreneur in this position commonly deals with the following challenges. Responsibility for multiple business functions, which makes it difficult to sell consistently. Lack of prospects in pipeline. Receiving "I'll think it overs" from prospects. And unexplained lack of growth over periods of months or years. For a prospect in this position, I might share the story of a past client of mine with relevant hurt. Bill, an entrepreneur who started his own screen printing company. Bill founded the company in his late 20s. Thanks to some large corporate clients, business grew quickly and steadily for about 15 years. His sales were up to about $5 million by the time that I had met him. He had built a comfortable life for his family, but recently his industry had changed. Clients were price checking him against large online vendors, many of which were overseas. Sales had begun to slump and margins tightened. Bill had never really thought of himself as a salesperson. With the exception of having to attend the occasional client lunch or presentation, sales generally rolled in on their own. But now that had changed. Bill had to generate sales or he was going to have to lay off employees who had been with him for over a decade. He would have to cut back on personal expenses, maybe even sell his home. The problem was that Bill simply didn't know where to start. He had hired a telemarketer, but that didn't work. He had tried a direct mail campaign, but really got no responses. He even tried to stop in on some large companies nearby, but he never got past the gatekeeper. When Bill joined my Game Plan Selling Platinum Coaching Program, the first thing that I did was get him up to speed on the Game Plan Selling System. I taught him how to be distinct from the competition and how to use the three steps of the game plan. Bill immediately loved the idea of building connections with prospects. He knew he was good at building rapport, mostly by talking about the Red Sox or Celtics, but he had never thought about going beyond that. He began matching and mirroring his prospects, and he made sure that his sales calls were focused on the prospects' issues and challenges, not on his services and products. He explained how this technique immediately took pressure off him. He used to hate tap dancing in front of a client, as he put it. And now he could just be genuine and even get more results. Disqualifying prospects was a big change in mindset for Bill. Once he began using the script of questions to uncover prospects' hurt and identify whether they were qualified for his services, he was able to understand prospects on a much deeper level. Furthermore, he told me that he realized it wasn't just about price anymore. It was about how he was rescuing his clients from their challenges. After giving his first case study presentation, Bill noticed that his prospects were far more interested in what he had to say as they could actually visualize what he could do for them. Finally, I helped him develop his prospecting playbook, a compilation of prospecting activities that he could track and perform on a daily basis to generate sales leads. Within 6 months of working together, Bill landed a deal with a major corporate client as its sole provider of screen printing, a contract worth $200,000 a year, as well as a few new mid-sized clients. He explained how these new clients treated him differently from his old clients because they saw him as a partner and as a marketing resource rather than just a t-shirt guy. Remember, once you're presenting to a prospect, you're at your most vulnerable. You're no longer in the position to disqualify a prospect. You've tacitly acknowledged that you think that this prospect is a fit by presenting your service or product. With this in mind, it's important to focus on two things in particular. First, like I said earlier, is that you want to keep the presentation as short as possible. Don't go any longer than you have to. The second point is that you want to let the prospect interrupt you during the presentation. If the prospect so much as looks like she's about to say something, stop and ask, "Did you have a question about that?" If the prospect asks you a question, use your swim move. By encouraging questions and comments during your presentation, you're keeping it collaborative. After you've completed your presentation, it's time for your big closing statement. Except it's not a statement. It's actually a question. What would you like to do next? If the prospect is ready to move forward, then he will let you know. On the other hand, he may tell you that this is not the right solution. However, if you did a thorough job in the disqualification phase, then this is an unlikely outcome. If the prospect is not ready to move forward, he will more than likely tell you that he needs to think it over. If the prospect tells you that he wants to think it over, do not accept the statement at face value. He may simply need more help in getting to the close. This is the part where you want to say what you're actually thinking. If you think that the prospect is trying to tell you no, but wants to be nice, then say so. Gently tell the prospect that it sounds like he doesn't want your product or service. If you've done a thorough job up until now, he will push back at you and say, no, that's not the case. This is where your swim move comes into play. Again, ask, what do you mean when you say that this isn't the case? He will explain. In the event that a prospect cannot make a decision in that particular meeting, be sure to schedule a very clear next step while you're still in that face-to-face meeting. Don't allow for vague next steps. You want to schedule something solid. Note, I don't spend a lot of time on this part of the sale because the most important part of the meeting is the beginning. If you're getting tremendous pushback towards the end of a meeting, it's probably because you didn't effectively disqualify or identify where the prospect hurts. This is the end of the three parts of the game plan selling, connect, disqualify, case study presentation. You've now learned how to think, act, and present to your advantage during any selling situation. As you use this system more and more, you'll find that it gets considerably easier with practice. Don't be afraid to have a script for every single part of selling. You don't have to be creative, just follow the system. It's time to begin to use your new game plan selling system today. The following section will prepare you to test out your new approach by developing your prospecting playbook. Chapter 13, Your Prospecting Playbook. Getting better at sales is just like improving at any sport. If you just show up to the game and play, you're never going to improve. In fact, that's the ultimate recipe for failure. Optimism has its place, but what is most important is that you have a clear and effective playbook to follow that you can practice during the week with militant discipline. Then, when game day comes, you won't have to think at all. You'll be ready. You can't expect sales to come to you. You need to get out there and utilize your prospecting playbook. This section of the book will walk you through the two key elements of a great prospecting playbook. First off, the five most important prospecting activities are, number one, cloud calls, making prospecting calls only to prospects in the highest relevant positions. Two, introductions. Referrals are often ineffective. Introductions are what fill your bank account. Three, selling deeper. Sell more by providing more value to current clients. Four, targeted networking. Develop relationships that lead to business. And five, speaking to sell. Give speeches as an expert to find prospects. Eventually, all five of these prospecting activities will be in your prospecting playbook. We'll explore more in depth why each of these activities are so important. I'll also explain how to best accomplish each one. In the end, it will be up to you to determine which activities give you the best results and are worth your time. Your goal is to fully maximize your return on time invested in prospecting. Beside these five activities, your prospecting playbook will also include your day-to-day routine. Gone are the days of waking up in the morning and asking yourself, what should I do today to generate sales? Client case study. One of my longest client relationships is with a high-end landscape construction company. This company sells landscape construction services to homeowners in some of the wealthiest towns in America. Their typical project will sell at anywhere between $20,000 and $500,000. When I first met John, the president and owner, over 6 years ago, he had seven salespeople generating a total of $6 million per year. Because the company had been around for over 50 years, John had bought the company 20 years prior, they had a reputation in the market as a leading provider. For the last 20 years, business had simply rolled in the door. The seven salespeople really never had to do any prospecting. Then, Right before I began working with John, the market changed. Not only did the economy screech to a halt, but the housing market plunged. What was once an obvious investment in home value was suddenly a luxury that many couldn't afford. Home and landscaping improvements were likely not going to increase the value of a home at an equal level to the money put into the project. John explained to me early on how it all seemed to happen at once. What was a loud and high-energy office one day was deafeningly silent the next. The sales team didn't know what to do. They were paid on commission and needed to continue to make money, but they had no idea where to start. Pressure mounted as fewer and fewer leads trickled in. Their initial solution was to lower prices, but that depleted their once large margins and didn't even lead to more sales. Their place in the market had seemed so solid. They were comfortable in their role as an industry-leading high-end company. Now that they were losing business, they struggled to keep up high-value appearances in a lower-value position. The company told the salespeople to start calling old clients to try to drum up business. But the efforts were haphazard. Salespeople would call clients when they could, spending most of their time designing proposals. Enough calls weren't being made. The team's morale suffered as the stress continued to build. There didn't seem to be a solution in sight. John was hurting tremendously when I met him. He knew what his company was doing wasn't working. So I developed a plan to zero in on three key elements. Number one, make sure the right salespeople are on his team. Number two, teach the team a systematic approach to selling. And number three, develop prospecting playbooks for all of the salespeople to follow. For our purposes right now, I'm not going to go deeply into the first two areas of focus. Suffice it to say that as soon as the team began using the game plan selling system, they instantly began converting more sales. What's most important to note in this particular case is that I developed a unique prospecting playbook for each salesperson. First, I taught the salespeople to get introductions from clients, do targeted networking to establish strategic relationships with other suppliers, and finally, sell more to their enormous list of clients. For each salesperson, I created a prospecting playbook that consisted of a specific number of prospecting activities to be done each day. These prospecting activities took priority over all other responsibilities. Each salesperson was to ask a certain number of current clients for introductions, contact a specific number of people about possible strategic relationships, and call a predetermined number of former clients every single day. These were all activities that allowed for high return on invested time for the salespeople. Each day they did the exact same things, followed their prospecting playbooks. The way we determined each salesperson's specific numbers for each activity was determined by what each salesperson wanted to earn. Each salesperson came up with this number on his or her own, just as you will shortly. This process linked the salespeople's personal goals to their prospecting activities. From there, we worked backwards. We determined how many sales on average the salesperson needed to make each month in order to hit his yearly commission goal. Once we had that number, we estimated how much of each activity the salesperson had to do daily, i.e., how many old clients he had to call each day, to reach that goal. Once the salespeople had these daily activity goals, they knew exactly what they needed to do in order to hit their numbers. There was very little pushback on this because they felt empowered by having a clear prospecting playbook. In this case, all of the additional prospecting only created an additional hour of work per day for each salesperson. But after implementing the game plan selling system, each salesperson reported saving over 3 hours a day as they were no longer chasing and putting together proposals for unqualified leads. This meant a net gain of 2 hours a day. In the end, sales increased by over 30% over the next year. John was thrilled with the increase in sales, and the salespeople were excited about their bigger commissions, more free time, and less stress. Crafting your own prospecting playbook means identifying activities that make sense for your selling situation, and then determining how much of each activity you need to do in order to achieve your personal financial goals. Some tools I found particularly useful for this process include Google Documents spreadsheets for tracking activities and Salesforce.com for a more robust tracking and prospecting system. As I've said before, I want to take the time to explain each of the five different prospecting activities in more detail. Please keep in mind that not all of these will be perfect for every single listener. On the other hand, some people will find that all five are critical to their success. Be open-minded as you read through the ins and outs of each. But first, let's get into the prospecting mindset. Jealously guard your time. When it comes to your prospecting playbook, you should jealously guard your time. Many salespeople run their day without planning how to maximize their time. It's this mindset that ultimately leads to a lack of a sense of urgency. And a lack of a sense of urgency leads to wasted time. First, it's important to establish what you're worth on an hourly basis to your organization. I recommend that you use the worksheet on page 100 in the hard copy book and follow along using a calculator for any math that you may have to do. Your hourly rate. How much revenue did you personally bring in through sales last year? Or how much do you realistically expect to bring in sales this year? This is your annual sales figure. Write it down on page 100. Next, how many hours do you work in an average week? Just ballpark the number of hours and write it down. Next, multiply the number above by 50 weeks. That means the number of hours in your work week by 50. What does that equal? This is the total number of hours that you work in a year. Now, simply divide your annual sales figure from above by the number of hours you work in a year. This means that annual sales number divided by the total number of hours you worked in a year. What does that equal? You have just calculated your hourly rate to your company, and it's probably much higher than you might have imagined. This means that your job as a salesperson is to maximize each hour as much as possible. Wasted time checking emails, calling prospects who will never work with you, or grabbing lunch with anyone who invites you out must become a thing of the past. The five activities that we are about to explore are all about maximizing your return on time invested in prospecting. If someone wants to meet with you, but you know it will be a waste of time, then don't do it. Wasted time costs you and your company thousands, maybe even millions of dollars. Which prospecting activities you ultimately use depends entirely on your situation. I'll start with a cloud call, not because it's most effective, but because it sets the foundation conceptually for many of the other prospecting activities. Let's begin. Chapter 14. Cloud calls. Make prospecting calls only to prospects in the highest relevant positions. Most salespeople are uncomfortable with cold calls. Nobody enjoys making them. I can always identify dishonest people in a room of salespeople by asking, who loves to make cold calls? Inevitably, someone will raise their hand. They're liars. Cold calls are not fun. They're hard. No matter how good you are at making cold calls, you will get hung up on, cut off, and rejected frequently. It's a tough racket. I've made more of them than I care to count, but I've also made a lot of money by making cold calls. Low-level prospects provide salespeople with instant gratification because they're happy to waste a salesperson's time, but they rarely ever buy. If a salesperson sells widgets to manufacturers, for example, he may call anyone with the title of buyer. This is a huge mistake. Selling to a buyer is hard. These folks are inundated with calls all day long, and they're the savviest when it comes to handling salespeople. Often, they aren't even the economic buyers. They usually need to get permission from their bosses just to change vendors. Salespeople should be calling in the highest positions relevant to the sale. In some cases, it might be the CEO. In others, it might be the VP of operations. This is called cloud calling because you're aiming up towards the clouds rather than down into the mud. I know it sounds intimidating, but it works. Let me show you. I explained earlier how when I first began selling, I went from gas station to gas station selling my services. While gas station owners are, in fact, decision makers, they would often have to apply for supplementary money from the oil company in order to purchase my services. In many cases, for example, ExxonMobil would reimburse a franchisee or a gas station owner for half of the money he spent on a grand opening promotion. So there I was, banging my head against the wall, selling at the lowest level possible for years. Mind you, the owners of gas stations are very busy people. They can also be some of the toughest people to sell to. Just think, if you made your living selling 75-cent candy bars and $1 bottles of water, you would hold your money pretty close to the vest. I made some sales, but it was hard work, and I could only sell one promotion at a time this way. I was getting an extremely low return on time I invested in prospecting. Then I learned a new way of selling. A mentor of mine told me to start calling at much higher levels. I was skeptical. I told him I didn't know where to find these people and that they were probably really busy and wouldn't want to talk to me. He ignored my sad pleas and challenged me to do it. I was apprehensive, but I accepted the challenge. As soon as I did, I immediately realized how effective it was. I had always wanted to expand my promotion business to work with fast food chains, but I'd never done anything about it. So I figured that maybe this would be a good opportunity to try my experiment. This way, even if I failed miserably, I wouldn't be risking any contacts with the gas stations that were my bread and butter. I'll never forget that experience. I was in a new Subway sandwich shop in Worcester, Massachusetts, and I struck up a friendly conversation with the franchisee. After a few minutes, I asked him if they had done any grand opening promotions for his store. He said they didn't do much, but he wished that they had. I asked him if he knew someone at Subway Corporate who might be in charge of that kind of a program. He told me to hold on, and he grabbed his cell phone. Within 3 minutes, I had the name of the VP of Experimental Marketing for Subway Sandwich Shops. This guy was the guy in charge of experimental marketing for all 3,000 U.S. locations. A one-hour cold call and two face-to-face meetings later, I was being paid to test out a brand new concept for grand openings at Subway stores. Getting such a huge client ultimately allowed my brother and me to sell our business. Those cloud calls that led to our work with Subway had an incredibly high return on time we invested. It's time for you to cloud call. It takes just as much time and effort to call high as it does to call low. And even more surprising is that it's usually easier to get a high-level person to talk to you. They have way less work to do than those in lower positions. People at the highest levels are actually lonely because they're so isolated. They don't get as much interaction, and they get sold to less because people at the lower levels usually handle that stuff. Even if you call a CEO and she tells you that she doesn't handle sales decisions, you can ask her to connect you to the appropriate person. And the CEO knows better than anyone else who that is. Plus, an introduction from the CEO is very powerful. Cloud calls are the only effective way to cold call. It's simply not an efficient use of your time to cold call low-level people. Although my Sales Strategy Academy program deals much more thoroughly with call technique, I want to dedicate a small portion of this section to basic call structure. Below is an example of a call made to the CEO of a $300 million manufacturing company with 50 salespeople. By the way, with a company this small, I would never want to speak to an employee lower than the CEO. Even the VP of sales or sales manager at a company this size rarely has the authority to bring a sales coach in. I will first try the CEO multiple times, either before 7:30 a.m. or after 6 p.m. CEOs work much longer hours than the receptionists. Therefore, the most productive hours to prospect CEOs is either before or after the standard 8:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. workday. My call to the CEO. Hello, Dave speaking. Hi, Dave. Mark Wayshack calling. It sounds like I caught you in the middle of something there. Actually, I am busy, but I have a second. What's up? Okay, great. Well, I'll tell you briefly why I called, and if it's not a fit, just tell me and we can hang up. Fair? Fair. I'm a sales coach that works with mid-sized businesses to create a game plan for selling. My clients tend to come to me when they're losing too many sales to low-cost competitors, struggling to hit their quarterly revenue goals, or finally, they're just getting inconsistent results from their sales teams. Do any of those issues ring true to you? Actually, we have been struggling to hit our revenue goals this past year. Tell me a little bit more about that. Well, it's been a tough year overall, and the sales team keeps, and the call goes on and on and on. Next, I would take the CEO through an abbreviated disqualification checklist to see if he's a qualified prospect. If he is, I will suggest that we set up a meeting during which time I will take him through the entire game plan selling system. Notice in that prospecting call that I gave the prospect three challenges that he would likely relate to. I want you to think back to using your opening play and just applying it to a phone call. If you want to call a high-level prospect but don't know who the particular contact is, there are a few very simple strategies. First, go to the company's website. Almost all company websites have the names and titles of the executives. If not, go to LinkedIn.com and do an advanced search with the company name, and you can narrow the results by title. Once you have the person's name, you can call the company's main number and use the dial-by-name directory. Jigsaw.com or data.com are great resources as well. For a small fee, you can often get someone's direct contact info. The point is, with a little creative effort, you can get the contact information for anyone. And by calling high-level people either really early in the morning or after hours, you can often get through. You want to have a script for every call you make. When I make a call like this, I have a script to look at. I don't care if it's my 37,452nd cold call, I am always looking at a script. Type up or write down your script and stick to it. Chapter 15, Introductions. Referrals are often ineffective. Introductions are what will fill your bank account. Depending on where you are in your career, cloud calls may not be one of your highest priority activities. But in any case, introductions must be a major part of your sales strategy. First, let's clarify why I love the term introduction and dislike the term referral. It's very simple. Referral is just a vague buzzword in the sales world. I can't tell you the number of times I've asked for referrals only to get a letter of recommendation. However, when you ask for an introduction, there is no question about what you want. We're in the business of getting introductions. Stop asking for anything else. What I've found is that clients are happy to introduce you to others if they have received value from your relationship. It is a no-brainer to ask clients for introductions. Happy clients know other like-minded people, so it should be easy to grow exponentially if you have a solid client base. So why aren't most salespeople getting introductions? Fear. Most salespeople have a subconscious fear that clients will get angry or even annoyed if asked to make an introduction. This is unfounded and is costing most salespeople a substantial amount of money. I have asked for thousands of introductions in my career, and do you know how many clients I've lost because of it? None. It's time to get past the irrational fear of asking clients for introductions. Just think of how much business you lost this past year by not asking every single client and business associate you know for an introduction. I expect my clients to introduce me to everyone they possibly can. Of course, in most cases, a typical client knows less than 4 ideal prospects for me. But that's not bad. Let's explore the math. If every client of mine introduces me to 2 solid prospects per year, and I close sales with half of those people, I will double my business every year by merely asking for introductions. When it comes to introductions, there is only one word you really need to know: help. When people we like and care about ask us for help, we want to help. When you ask your satisfied clients for help, they'll want to help you too. Just like in the connect phase of game plan selling, you need to be authentic. Here's an example of how I ask clients for introductions. Dan, do you feel like I've provided a lot of value for you? Oh yeah, Mark. It's been an amazing experience working with you. I'm so glad to hear that, Dan. What have you found most valuable? Well, Mark, before working with you, I really struggled with selling. Now that I feel like I have control of the sale, plus, my sales are way up. Dan, that makes me feel great. I'd like to ask you for some help. Of course. What is it? The single most important way that I grow my business is by providing so much value to my clients that they want to introduce me to others that I might be able to help. Would you be willing to introduce me to some people that you know? Sure, Mark, of course. But I'll have to think about who would make sense. Dan, I really appreciate that. Would it be helpful if I gave you an outline of my ideal client? Yes, of course, Mark. Okay, Dan. Well, my ideal client is, and this is where you'd want to be as specific as possible describing your ideal client. And then continue, do any people come to mind? Well, Mark, actually, I can't believe I didn't think of this before, but my two golfing buddies would be a great fit. Dan, that sounds great. Would you be willing to call them up and see if they'd actually take my call? Note, an email is acceptable as well with a CC to you, but a phone call is always stronger. No problem, Mark. Thank you so much, Dan. That's amazing. I can't tell you how much I appreciate this. When do you think you might have time to actually speak with these people? Well, I could actually call right now and give you a call back in a few minutes if that works. Sounds amazing. This is a conversation that you can have with every single one of your clients. Of course, not all clients are going to be able to introduce you to the right prospects. Some don't know enough people, some are too shy, some don't like you enough, but some of your clients, many of your clients will. This simple technique can increase your sales dramatically right away. Moving forward, you want to get in the habit of asking for introductions all day long, even prospects and acquaintances. Of course, you won't use the exact same script as above, but you just fit it to the right situation. A few years back, I met one of my top clients through a prospect who wasn't a fit. At the end of our meeting, we decided that her company wasn't going to invest at the level that was necessary, so we amicably decided not to move forward. However, at the end of the meeting, I asked her if she knew anyone else at companies like hers that might be a fit, and she did. I asked her if she'd be willing to see if that contact would take my call. She picked up the phone right then, called him, and then handed me the phone. We scheduled a call for later that week, and a month later, we began our first project. The moral of the story is that you should ask everyone for introductions. Of course, the best time to set the stage for introductions with clients is at the very beginning of a relationship. My policy is that immediately after I close a sale, I explain to my new client that I intend to provide so much value to him that he'll want to introduce me to his friends and colleagues. In fact, I even hand the new client a sheet describing my ideal client. This way, the client knows what to look for. The key to getting introductions is asking for them. In the end, don't worry so much about exactly how you ask. Just be sincere, ask for help, and do it frequently. It is a necessity. Chapter 16, Selling Deeper. Sell more by providing more value to current clients. Every salesperson has an asset, and most of the time it's an undervalued asset. That asset is the current client. Unfortunately, many salespeople out there, and I've certainly been guilty of this at times myself, are always thinking about where the next client is going to come from rather than where the next sale is going to come from. Where the next client is going to come from is a question of prospecting, precluding you from potential additional sales you could make from within your already existing customer base. Where the next sale is going to come from includes your current customers in the list of possible candidates that can buy more of your services. The more you can sell to clients you already have, the easier it is to generate sales. Let's dig into the math a little bit and calculate the cost of acquiring a new client. Following up on an example I discussed earlier about John's landscape construction company, let's imagine that a prospect calls into the office and ultimately becomes a client. How much did John's company invest in order to acquire that client? Well, let's imagine that the new client found John's company through one of the many marketing efforts the company employs. I happen to know that they invest about $200,000 a year in total marketing expenditure geared toward acquiring new clients. If they bring on 50 new clients from that investment, which is realistic, then they have paid $4,000 upfront for each new client. That's $200,000 divided by 50 new clients equals $4,000 spent per new client acquired. the cost of a salesperson's time to actually close the sale with a new client can range all the way up to around $5,000. That means that the company spent a total of about $9,000 to bring in just one new client. That is a lot of money. Have you calculated what it costs you right now to acquire new clients? It's probably a lot more than you think. Let's figure it out. I highly recommend that you follow along on page 120 of the hard copy book in order to calculate the cost to acquire a new client. Marketing cost to acquire a new client. A. Write down the total cost of marketing geared toward acquiring new clients in the past year. Labor cost to acquire a new client. B. Write down the percent of time you and or your salespeople spend prospecting, meeting with new prospects, working on presentations, and following up with prospects. This includes all new sales activity in the past year. Write down the percentage of time spent right now. Note, if you're a salesperson, this number should be close to 100%. However, if you're an entrepreneur, this number may be lower. C. What was the annual labor cost for you and or your sales team? This is the total amount, including base salaries, commissions, and benefits. Write down that number now. D. Now multiply line B by line C, remembering that B is a percent. Write that number down. It should give you a dollar figure. E. Now add line A and line D together. That's the marketing cost and the labor cost together. Write down that number. This is your total expenditure for acquiring new clients. F. Write down the number of new clients acquired in the past year. Finally, divide line E by line F. That will give you a dollar sum. This is your approximate cost for bringing on each new client. I imagine that you're looking at a pretty large number. The game plan selling system will help you shrink it. Your clients are going to perceive you as an advisor and resource rather than just as a provider of the features and benefits of your product or service. It's time to stop defining yourself only by your product or service you currently provide. Present yourself as the person to whom your clients can turn to in order to solve their problems. This means picking up the phone and having open and frank conversations with your clients about their challenges. You can use the exact same questions in the disqualification phase of game plan selling. Take your existing clients through that same process. When you do this, one of two things, or both, is going to happen. You might discover that your client is not fully satisfied with the product or service that you're currently providing. This is an amazing opportunity to right the wrong. The other thing that may happen is that you will identify some challenges that you can solve with other products that you sell or can create. Selling more products to a good client is one of the easiest sales that can be made. You've already established trust with the client, so helping that client in different ways is logical. Change your mindset from always finding new clients to providing as much value as possible to your current clients. If you already have a range of products and services that you can sell to your current clients, great. If not, create them based on the feedback you get from conversations with your current clients. This section wouldn't be complete if I didn't share with you two best practices I've learned from clients along the way. I've had a number of clients who sell a particular product and struggle to think of other products that would be a complementary fit for their clients. Worry no more. It doesn't have to be a product. Maybe a service would offer the most value to your clients. Many companies that sell a product or a range of products have a particular expertise. Think about what expertise you have that you can offer your clients on a consulting basis. There's a plethora of information on the internet, but expertise is one of the scarcest resources to come by in today's world. If you can identify a specific hurt that your clients are consistently feeling, then you have identified a tremendous opportunity to help them on a paid consulting basis. Don't be afraid to tout the value of your expertise. There's a saying that one of my mentors once told me that has always stuck with me. Expertise that is obvious to you may be worth a lot of money to someone else. Chances are you're a wealth of information to your clients. you should be paid appropriately for that information. Providing a subscription service to your clients is another best practice. This can be a relatively lower fee service that will provide consistent value and keep you closely connected to your clients. For example, John's Landscape Construction Company offered a tree and plant spray service that would protect clients' yards from insects and disease. This relatively low-fee service, under $1,000 per year, had his company working on clients' properties multiple times per year. Even better, part of this service included a face-to-face annual review with the salesperson at the client's house. This meant that the salespeople were essentially being paid to conduct annual sales meetings with their best clients. During this meeting, they could also identify new issues in the yard. When I first began working with this company, only 1/3 of their clients were part of this program. One of the first changes we made was to make this program a mandatory part of each sale. A 1-year subscription to the program was now included automatically. Another good example is Danny's internet marketing company, which, like many companies in that field, was in the business of selling large contracts that would end at a specific time, after which they would try to sign the client up for a new project. This was an uncertain process. Instead, we created the Internet Marketing Maintenance Program. With this program, clients would pay only a few $1,000s per year to have Danny's company regularly test their internet marketing strategies. Each quarter, Danny's company would present clients with a strengths and weaknesses report of their internet marketing efforts. It wasn't a lot of work for Danny's company to do this, as low-level people could collect all of the data, but it was tremendously valuable to clients. Moreover, it meant that Danny's company was conducting a meeting with their best clients every quarter. As a result, they were always on their clients' radar. The clients were delighted to have these reports, and Danny was able to resell his clients on new projects more easily and consistently. Even if a client chose not to renew a large contract with Danny's company, they would often continue with the Internet Marketing Maintenance Program. This meant that the company stayed relevant and was more likely to get work down the road. What type of a subscription service can you offer to your clients? Remember that it's all about getting regular FaceTime with your best clients. Now that you see yourself as a trusted advisor, how can you provide more value that ultimately allows you to sell more? In today's competitive world, it costs too much money to only find new clients. Game plan selling is all about the greatest return on time. How can you sell more deeply to your best clients in a way that is providing incredible value, keeping you closely connected, and making you a lot more money? Chapter 17, Targeted Networking, Develop Strategic Relationships That Lead to Business. I cannot tell you how many networking lunches I had early on in my sales career that went nowhere because I was willing to sit down with just about anyone. Those types of random networking meetings are just an excuse to pretend that we're doing something productive. In reality, we're just hiding from our real prospecting activities. On the other hand, targeted networking can be one of the most effective ways to both short-term and long-term sources of business. Yet, as with any other aspect of selling, you must have a game plan. Meeting with just anyone is simply not strategic and will waste more time than you can afford to lose. Remember what your hourly rate is. Make the absolute best of every working hour spent. Let's explore how to ensure that your networking is highly targeted. There are two important components to networking: where to network and how to do it effectively. Where to network. There are two places to consider for networking: where your prospects are, and where people that know your prospects are. Both can be excellent options for developing a network. There is no right or wrong answer in terms of where to start. The key is that you approach this challenge with the goal of maximizing your return on time invested in networking. When I first began my career as a sales coach, my biggest strategy for finding prospects was speaking to audiences of company executives that would ultimately hire me to train their sales teams. In order to book those speeches, I connected with meeting planners and people who put on conferences. So in a sense, my initial clients were meeting planners and I networked accordingly. I started by asking my prospects where they networked. This, by the way, is one of the simplest strategies for finding great networking opportunities. Just ask your ideal clients and prospects. After doing some research and checking out a few different associations, I decided to get involved with two organizations. I joined the National Speakers Association, known as NSA, which is a group of speakers that present to companies and organizations around the world. I committed myself to the New England chapter of NSA, regularly attending meetings. There were two compelling reasons that made me want to invest my time and energy into this association. First, there were people in NSA who had businesses I wanted to emulate. It became an excellent place for me to find mentors, people that could advise me on how to grow my business. There were also many members in this association that knew the meeting planners with whom I wanted to connect. My goal was not to sell anything to anyone in NSA, but rather to get connected with the prospects that the members knew personally. The other association I got involved with was Meeting Planners International, MPI, an association for meeting planners. This association, unlike NSA, was where my prospects were. I made it a point to go to as many MPI New England chapter meetings as I possibly could. This is highly targeted networking for me because almost everyone at one of these events could hire me in some capacity. Even the vendors at MPI could hire me or at least connect me with people who could. Now that you've seen examples of two types of places to network, where your prospects are and where people who know your prospects are, what are some ideal places for you to target? What you want to avoid are networking opportunities or associations where mostly low-level people go to socialize. Just as with cloud calls, you want networking opportunities that provide you access to high-level people that can either make the decision to buy from you or introduce you to the person who can. How to network effectively. Once you've established where you're going to network, the next step is to figure out how to network. To be clear, there is not one silver bullet on this topic, but there are some best practices when it comes to maximizing your return on time invested in networking. Above all, when it comes to any type of networking, you need to have both short-term and long-term goals. Short-term goals are often underappreciated. Many networking groups will tell their members that it's all about being involved for the long term. This is simply not true. Before a salesperson even shows up to a networking event, he should have a very clear goal of what he's going to do at the event. Whenever I go to a networking event, I set a specific goal for myself of how many people I intend to meet, depending on how long I intend to be at the event. Even more specifically, I will identify the types of people I want to meet. For example, a typical goal for a Meeting Planners International meeting would be to connect with 10 different meeting planners. At an NSA meeting, my goal would be to set up a lunch with a specific speaker who might be able to introduce me to high-level meeting planners. Whatever the networking opportunity, I have a clear short-term goal I want to accomplish. Usually, longer-term goals revolve around becoming a trusted provider of services to the members of an organization, or the people most likely to refer business to you. This often takes time. The key here is to be around consistently and maybe even get involved as a volunteer. If done properly, getting involved with an organization can be a great way to get more face time with your mentors, prospects, or sources of introductions. Always jealously guard your time. And if you start to see your effort is exceeding what you're getting in return, then it's time to reassess. If you want to volunteer somewhere with no expectation of getting something in return, then get involved with charities or nonprofits outside of work. Having said that, my experiences with volunteering on well-chosen committees have given me tremendous access to key personnel. Now that I've helped them out, they are more willing to help me out too. Working the room. Let's be clear, networking isn't easy. There's nothing more stressful than walking into a room full of strangers with the expectation that you have to approach them. I still feel overwhelmed the first second I walk into a networking event where I don't know anyone. However, I have learned to be effective at networking with a few very simple strategies. Your goal. Walk into the room with a goal, but make sure it's realistic. If I'm about to attend a networking event with hundreds of possible prospects, I want to know how much time I'll have to complete that goal. For example, let's say there's a cocktail hour before the event's speaker comes on. Then after the speech, there's another half hour before the event ends. That leaves me with a 90-minute window of time to network. In 90 minutes, a realistic goal would be to meet and connect with 10 prospects. I make a promise to myself that I won't go home until I have the contact information of at least 10 people. There are no excuses or exceptions here. I don't particularly enjoy networking, so if I let myself off the hook, I know that I will never meet my goal. Warm up. The first 3 people will be the most difficult to approach. Once I'm mentally and socially warmed up, networking becomes much easier. The second I walk into an event, I strike up a conversation with the first person I see. Every fiber of my being is usually telling me to go to the bar, but that's the worst thing I can do. It will just waste time and keep me stuck inside my own head. It doesn't matter if the first person you talk to is the bellman at the conference center. Just strike up a conversation. Follow your first conversation with 2 more random chats. Note, these do not count towards your goal, by the way, cheater. Conversation starter. What you say to start a conversation doesn't matter. What matters is that you start the conversation. Having said that, there's one line that I find to be very effective at striking up conversations at networking events. What brings you to this event? If you have something else you'd like to say, great. But don't get caught up on what to say. Just ask the first question. After starting a conversation, you always want to try to ask that first question. Of course, if you do get asked what you do before you have the chance, just use your rehearsed opening play. But ideally, before you get to talk about what you do, you want to ask the person, who are you looking to meet at this event? Depending on how the person answers your question, you'll be able to quickly determine whether this person is worth your valuable time to continue speaking to. With that question, you'll also automatically shift the focus toward the other person. Remember, most people are terrible at networking and only care to talk about themselves. Also, pay attention to what people tell you so that you can make a connection. If you're the only person making connections at the very start of a networking event, you've just moved yourself to the top of the social food chain in everyone's eyes. People will notice that. Your opening play. Eventually, the person is going to ask you what you do. Like I said earlier, when this happens, you'll use your opening play, but you'll tweak it just slightly. My opening play at a networking event goes something like this. I'm a sales strategist who works with mid-sized businesses to create a game plan for selling. Today, I'm looking to meet CEOs who are losing too many sales to low-cost competitors, struggling to hit quarterly revenue goals, or getting inconsistent results from their sales teams. If the person I'm talking to is a CEO with those problems, she'll tell me so. Then I'll take her through an abbreviated disqualification checklist. If she's qualified, I'll recommend that we set up a meeting or a phone call. We can exchange cards too. All that matters is that I have her information. When networking, never just give out cards with the expectation of getting a call back. That is a total waste of time. Get help from connectors. If you talk to enough people at a networking event, you will eventually find a connector. These are the people who know absolutely everyone of importance. When you come across a connector, add one more step. Ask them for their help. Here's exactly what to say. I'm new to this networking group, and I'm not great at networking. Do you think you might be able to help me connect with some people? I've had connectors walk me around from CEO to CEO all night, introducing me to everyone. Chapter 18, Speaking to Sell. There is simply no better way to establish yourself as an expert and do it on a grand scale than by speaking. I can imagine that many people are skeptical about this, so let's explore it a little bit. Do you know more about your product, service, or industry than your prospects do? I certainly hope so. You have valuable information that they want. And I'm not talking about the features and benefits of your product. I'm talking about the real expertise that you have. Let me give you an example of a coaching client of mine. I mentioned earlier that I had a client named Ben who sold high-end kitchen cabinets. His average sale was about $50,000 until we met, and he had acquired most of his clients through networking with groups like Business Networking International and his local Chamber of Commerce. He struggled to grow his business after the first 2 years. When we met, his company was thumping along at around $500,000 per year, which was half the revenue he believed his company should be generating. Ben immediately loved game plan selling because of the control it gave him over selling situations. But after a few months of working together, I knew there was more he could be doing to secure qualified prospects. When I suggested that he begin giving local talks on how to make your kitchen beautiful, he pushed back hard. Ben was really nervous about the idea of speaking in front of a group of people. I explained to him that there were so many people out there who simply hated their kitchens but didn't know where to start to make their kitchens look beautiful. After much back and forth, he agreed to at least try the concept. We worked together to create a short presentation that he could give to audiences, based on his expertise, not on his products. The presentation addressed the most common areas of hurt that people have about their kitchens. In his presentation, Ben talked about one client who wouldn't have dinner parties because she hated her kitchen, and about another who would eat out because she hated cooking in her ugly kitchen. The presentation was intended to last anywhere from 15 to 45 minutes. It was full of anecdotes. It included many funny pictures of ugly kitchens on the projector. It gave some very simple but good content, and most of all, it reminded the audience that they needed to update their kitchens. It was the perfect sales tool that established Ben as the expert. The last and most critical step was that at the end of the talk, he offered a free 5-page checklist of what you want to think about before updating your kitchen. Ben would hand out a simple form to collect names, email addresses, and phone numbers of those who wanted the checklist, and to talk with Ben later on to discuss their kitchens. There was no sales pitch. It was a win-win for the audience and for Ben. After a little bit of practice, Ben began calling some small groups like Rotaries, garden clubs, and other local networking groups. Within a few weeks, he was booking a speech per week. They were all no-fee speeches, but he was getting some outstanding leads from them. Notice how I said no fee instead of free. Free implies a very low-value commodity, and your expertise is anything but a low-value commodity. After a few more months, speaking was his primary tool for prospecting. It was so effective because it not only provided him with strong leads, but also gave him the image of an absolute expert. Key components of speaking to sell. Get over your fear of public speaking. Most people who don't take advantage of public speaking to generate leads do so out of fear, which is simply not a good reason to ignore one of the best tools you have to find prospects. When I first began speaking to groups, I was very nervous about it. In fact, I was scared to death. If you have any fear of public speaking, the best way to get past it is to practice. Join a local Toastmasters chapter, check out www.toastmasters.org, and get as much practice as possible. Not only will you become a better public speaker, but you will also build self-esteem by improving this area of your professional life. Identify expertise that your prospects want. In Ben's case, prospects wanted to know how to make their kitchens beautiful. What expertise do you have that your prospects want to learn from? I've never met a seasoned salesperson who doesn't have a high degree of expertise in something, so no excuses. Craft your speech. This is often the hardest part. I work extensively with my coaching and training clients to help them craft and perfect their speeches. Below is the basic structure every speech should have. Number 1, opening story. A case study. Tell a story about a client of yours who has dealt with challenges to which your audiences will relate. This opening story should last no more than about 3 minutes. 2, establish the main 1 to 3 points that your speech will address. If your speech is 15 minutes long, you only have time for 1 point. If your speech is 45 minutes long, you have time for about 3 points, but no more. 3, discuss your first point. Give at least 1 usable tip. 4, do the same with points 2 and 3. 5, close with one of the following. A brief final story tying together your points or a quote tying together your points. 6, offer to send your audience a special report, checklist, ebook, or article via email. Hand out a simple form asking for names and email addresses. Be sure that the form asks if they'd like to schedule a meeting or a phone call. Leave a space for phone numbers and best times to call. The key is that the speech is informative, includes some engaging stories, and focuses on challenges your audience likely faces. By the way, the special report or article that you offer to your audience can be anywhere from 500 to 3,000 words. It doesn't have to be anything fancy, just give them some solid content. Helpful tips to make a solid speech. Once you've written speech, get a little practice in front of friends and family. Use a PowerPoint presentation, but don't jam lots of words onto the slides. The slides should have at most a few very simple bullet points and lots of pictures. Keep it simple, and remember that your goal is not to be hilarious and incredible, but to identify qualified prospects. A qualified prospect won't care that you are super dynamic. He will care only that you know what you're talking about. Finding places to speak. Identify where your prospects will be and then get booked to speak there. You probably already know exactly where your prospects are. They'll be in many of the same places you're planning to network. Come up with a list of different groups and organizations your prospects might belong to. Get booked to speak. Many salespeople trip up trying to book speeches. They believe that they need a fancy website with lots of videos and flashy buttons. The truth is you don't need anything other than a one-page PDF document that states three things: the title of your speech, what your speech is about, who you are, and what you do. That's it. If you have a nice digital photo of yourself, include that in the document too. Once you begin to book some speeches and it becomes a serious opportunity to create business, then you can get fancier with a flashy website and professionally designed brochures. At the beginning, just focus on creating your speech and booking talks. Keep it simple. Feel free to check out my website at markwayshack.com for ideas on how to market your speaking. Once you have the PDF outlining your speech, it's time to begin contacting the list of organizations you put together. This is pretty simple. You just start calling the people that run the events and tell them that you're an expert on your topic. Ask them if they ever bring in speakers to talk about that particular subject. If so, offer to email your information along, follow up over the next few days. This is not the same type of sales call that we've been talking about up until now. In fact, it's really a marketing call. Remember, the person booking the event just wants to book a speaker who isn't going to make him or her look bad. So in this case, you want to have a very simple conversation to determine whether he has any interest in booking you to speak. Once you become more established as a speaker, these calls will get easier. But for now, start by making your speech marketing calls and getting those first few speeches booked. By being up there on stage, you become the expert on your topic to the audience. Once you've really honed your speech, qualified prospects will come flocking. And the clients who do come out of this prospecting activity will treat you like a true expert. They'll be easier to work with, introduce you to more people, and gladly pay you more money than any of your competitors. Chapter 19, A Note on Marketing. This is a book about selling, not marketing. However, that doesn't mean that I'm not a huge believer in marketing. I am. I love marketing. It has been an enormous part of my success. I love that sending out a simple postcard can get prospects to call and email me. I'm tickled when I get phone calls from companies that found me through a Google search. I feel fantastic when I learn that someone who saw me at a speech 2 years ago and signed up for my email list has been reading my emails every week. However, if you want to learn about marketing, then you should find other resources than this book. There are many books out there that can help you create the perfect marketing strategies to generate leads. Some areas of marketing that I recommend you learn about include search engine optimization, or SEO. Using your website, blogs, and online content to make Google and other search engines like you and hand deliver you prospects. Pay-per-click advertising. Creating campaigns on search engines where you pay for top placement every time a prospect clicks on your advertisement. Social media marketing. Using sites like Facebook and LinkedIn to gain a following and ultimately convert followers into clients. Lead nurturing. Using techniques such as weekly email tips to provide good content to prospects who may not be ready to buy from you at the moment. Direct mail. This lost art still works if you're creative, consistent, and targeted to attract new prospects. Public relations, getting the media to take interest in you, your company, and your expertise to gain exposure to your prospects. Or trade shows, getting a booth at a trade show to showcase your products or services. Many sales trainers downplay marketing and act like it's not a real way to find prospects. I could not disagree more. Especially in this day and age, marketing must be a part of your mix. Not exploring your marketing options is just as bad as not asking clients for introductions. Both leave money on the table. Chapter 20, Create Your Prospecting Playbook. Developing your prospecting playbook is discussed last in this book, not because it's least important, but because it's a culmination of everything you've learned thus far. In fact, creating your prospecting playbook will be the single most important thing that you do to instantly change your sales results. This simple tool will provide you the daily and weekly structure necessary to achieve your goals. Why every salesperson needs a playbook. In sports, there is a common misconception among fans that athletic prowess is all about innate talent. But if you ask any world-class athlete what was most important to her success in sports, she'll tell you that it was practice, not talent. Similarly, selling isn't about the one moment when you close a deal. It's about the hundreds of phone calls that you make to get a few promising leads. It's about the dozens of networking events that you attend to make a few solid connections. And at the end of the day, sales is a game of numbers and prospecting activities. There is no such thing as a professional goal in sales. Every cloud call you make, regardless of whether it leads to a sale or a dead end, brings you closer to achieving what you want in your personal life. Every activity you complete in your prospecting playbook is for one purpose: to put money in your bank account so you can create the life you want outside of work. This process is powerful and personal. It will be the difference between just going through the motions and doing everything you can to make each sale. This section will require that you write and do a little bit of math. You will want to follow along on page 151 in the hard copy version of your book. A calculator will be helpful as well. Because this may require more space, feel free to do the following exercise on a separate piece of paper. This is the most important exercise you will do for your career this year. Your prospecting playbook. Section A. What do you want to be able to have in your personal life over the next year? Write out in as much or as little detail the life you would like to create for yourself and your family. What will you buy? What do you want to achieve personally over the next year? Write it out now. For example, Jen wants to move into a new house in the next year. She wants to take her family to Disneyland for Christmas vacation and put $10,000 into her kids' college savings account. Section B. How much will all of those additions to your life cost you? Estimate a dollar figure. Write it down now. For example, this will cost Jen an additional $20,000. Section C. How much do you have to earn in order to support your goals? Calculate what your total annual pay must be. This includes bonus, commission, and salary. Write that number down now. For example, Jen will have to make a total of $100,000 in order to be able to afford all of this. Section D. Given your compensation structure, calculate what your total annual sales must be in order to earn what you need. Again, feel free to ballpark. Write this down now. This is now your annual sales goal. For example, Jen is an all-commission salesperson with no base salary, and she earns 10% of every sale she makes. Therefore, she must sell $1 million. Section E. What is your average sale, approximately, in dollars? Ballpark what an average sale is for you. Write this down now. For example, Jen's average product sale is around $20,000. Section F. How many sales do you need to make this year in order to hit your annual sales goal? This is where some math will come in. You calculate this number by dividing your annual sales goal by your average sale. That means divide the answer in section D by your answer in section E. Write this number down. For example, Jen will divide her $1 million sales goal by her average sale, which is $20,000. That means that Jen must make 50 sales this year in order to hit her goal. This is a critical number. Section G. In order to make one sale, how many initial sales meetings do you need to conduct? This is obviously going to be an estimate. Write your number now. For example, in order to make one sale, Jen probably has to set about 4 initial sales meetings. Section H. How many sales meetings must you set up this year in order to hit your sales goal? You calculate this by multiplying the number of sales you must make this year by the number of meetings you need in order to make a single sale. That means multiply section F by section G. Write this number down now. For example, Jen will multiply the 50 sales she must make by 4. That will equal 200. Jen must set up 200 sales meetings this year in order to hit her goal. Section I. How many sales meetings must you set up per week in order to hit this goal? Simply divide the number of sales meetings you must set up this year by 50, which is the number of weeks in a year with 2 weeks vacation. You will divide section H by 50. For example, Jen will divide the 200 meetings she has to set up in a year by 50. That means that Jen must set up 4 meetings per week in order to hit her sales goal. You must set up this number of meetings per week in order to achieve your goals. Now that we know how many meetings you must set up each week, it's time to figure out how much of which prospecting activities will get you to your goal. Here are some of the prospecting activities related to what we've discussed. Cloud calls. Introductions. Asking clients for introductions. Asking other people for introductions. Selling deeper. Client calls. Client meetings. Targeted networking. Events attended. Networking connections made, trade shows attended. Speaking to sell, speeches given, calls made to book speeches. And finally, marketing efforts. Only focus on efforts that you directly manage. Now, using the list above and your own ideas, make a list of all the key prospecting activities that you must do regularly. Come up with a list, prospecting activity 1, prospecting activity 2, and so on. Now, estimate how many times you must, on average, perform each activity in order to set up one meeting. For example, you might need to make 100 cloud calls in order to set up one meeting. Or you might need to ask for 5 introductions in order to actually get 2 introductions, which will lead to one meeting. Now write out the number of times that you must do a particular activity in order to set up just one meeting. Write this down for each activity. Now that you know how many times you must do your prospecting activities, it's time to match those numbers with the number of meetings that you must set up each week. This is where you're going to have to figure out your own mix. I'll continue with the example of Jen just so you can see how this works. So let's say that this is Jen's list of prospecting activities. Prospecting activity 1. Cloud calls. She figures that she must make 200 cloud calls in order to set up one good meeting. Prospecting activity 2, asking for introductions. She figures for every 5 introductions asked, she gets 2 introductions, which will ultimately lead to one meeting. Prospecting activity 3, networking events attended. She figures that at every networking event she attends, after following up on her prospects, she'll set up one meeting. Prospecting activity 4, calls to book a speech. She figures that she must make 100 speech calls in order to book one speech. And after every speech she gives, she sets up 2 meetings. Now Jen determines that in order to achieve her 4 sales meetings each week, she must make 200 cloud calls, which will lead to 1 meeting. She must ask for 5 introductions, which will also lead to 1 meeting. She must go to 1 networking event, which will lead to 1 meeting. And she must make 50 calls to book a speech, which will ultimately lead to 1 sales meeting. Now, to get her day-to-day activity goals, we just divide her weekly goals by 5, 5 days of the week. Therefore, each day, Jen must make 40 cloud calls, ask for 1 introduction, make 10 calls to book a speech, and she must also make sure that she attends 1 networking event each week. Jen has now identified exactly what she must do each day and week in order to achieve her $100,000 earnings goal. She now has a crystal clear prospecting playbook. In the hard copy worksheet on page 157, write out your daily goals for prospecting activities, from prospecting activity 1 to prospecting activity 2, and so on. Note that some prospecting activities are not daily. For example, it might only make sense to go to 1 networking event per week. In that case, just have a weekly goal for that prospecting activity. Now it's time to begin to track your prospecting activities on a daily basis. You can track your prospecting activities on paper, in an Excel spreadsheet, on a Google document, or however else you'd like. It's important to keep track of exactly what you're doing each day in order to get closer to your goals. As you begin to follow and track your prospecting activities, you might find that your ratios will change from what you originally expected. In that case, you can simply adjust your daily prospecting goals to reflect the new numbers. This is not a one-time process. I recommend that you recalculate your prospecting playbook regularly as your goals and sales abilities change. Be sure to hold yourself accountable and ideally have someone else to hold you accountable to your prospecting activities. I hold all of my clients accountable, but I also encourage them to have an accountability buddy who also holds them accountable. Find someone to hold you accountable and go get it done. Chapter 21, Parting Words. Not too long ago, I met a tech entrepreneur named Brian. Brian had passion and drive, but he simply didn't have an effective plan for his sales efforts. During our first conversation, he told me that he knew he needed help. He had a solid product, but he struggled to sell. He wasn't able to identify good prospects. He felt constantly underwater, like many entrepreneurs do. He was juggling the responsibilities of selling along with all of the other roles he played within his company. Worst of all, he had a 16-year-old son, and his biggest fear was that he wouldn't be able to afford his son's college tuition. As soon as I began coaching Brian, he was a man on a mission to turn his company and life around. Now that he had a game plan, all he had to do was follow through. With his prospecting playbook to guide him along, it was simply a matter of doing the things he knew he had to do. Within just 5 months, he brought on 2 very large clients, immediately doubling his business. This is not the story of every client I work with. In fact, I tell Brian's story because he is exceptional. Even with game plan selling in place, Brian's business could have continued to falter. But he followed the system without exception, and that made all the difference. Just like in sports, a coach and a plan can only do so much. In the end, the player himself has to find the drive and commitment to follow through and create an outcome of success. Brian's drive and hunger is what pushed him to follow every last bit of his prospecting playbook to the T. So live by the game plan selling DSP, by being distinct from the competition, being systematic for every aspect of selling, and having a prospecting playbook to live by. If you do, you will see an immediate change, but it will only take you so far. Like Michael Jordan once said, some people want it to happen, some wish it would happen, but others make it happen. Go make it happen by pushing yourself in all aspects of selling. And if you do, you will find your own sales greatness.